The Off the Ball Podcast Network.
OTB AM.
Brought to you by Pandora. Find the perfect gift this Valentine's Day.
Right, it is 7:31 this morning. You're very welcome along to OTB AM. It's a five-star OTB AM for you this morning. You've got Brian O'Driscoll coming your way a little bit later on. But we've also got a full house. Kenny Cunningham is here. Hasn't left for the last 24 hours. Kieran Donaghy is here. How are you?
Good job, it's fine, mate.
You're speechless. That's the first time ever.
Yeah. Well.
Owen Sheehan is here. Owen, how are you?
Very well. Any crack?
I mean, yeah, we've got a full house.
Let's get it on.
It's like the Rich Dad Cooper sketch where you're like, I'd love if I could sleep over there. Whereas actually, that is you, Kenny Cunningham. It's the situation where...
I feel a bit of an obligation if I don't... If work gets back to that I was over in Dublin, I didn't pop my head in. What? In the morning.
It'd be like you're cheating on us with the evening.
Yeah. I do feel a little bit of pressure.
Is the whole gap between you being on Off the Ball also in line with the whole gap between you not being in Dublin? Like, have you missed your Dublin breakfasts? Is this something that's been...
Dublin BAPS is your life? Your BAPS.
Yeah. Now, I always miss my Dublin breakfast. But you're right. Now, I haven't spent any... Not midweek. Haven't been spending a huge amount of time midweek. Hence, the enforced absence.
Where are you going for breakfast after this?
What do you reckon?
I don't know. Where did you take me that morning?
Let's be honest.
I was waiting
for the invitation.
I do, oh yeah.
I'm still waiting. I brought Kieran over
You haven't been here?
I brought Kieran for his first Dublin breakfast BAP some time ago.
Really?
Yeah. It was
good.
Where did you go?
Messy.
Literally physically attacked the BAP. It wasn't a free, so...
The two of us with ketchup running down our cheeks wasn't a good look.
He had his baptism before just off South William Street.
Right, very good. Well, we'll try and give different other breakfast places a shout out as well if you can think of any of the names.
Oh, there's too many jerseys.
Who knows, maybe somebody will send some in for us this morning. Kenny, last night, I'm not going to go over all ground, but you were talking about the Bournemouth players complaining about the referee complaining to them about the fact that they were complaining, right? So this was...
This is a non-story, Jerry. Are you really going to run with
well,
this?
Well, no, because...
Go on then.
You got to trust us here, right?
Okay.
Kieran has a story about referees. So this is just a setup, Kenny. An elaborate setup. But hang on a second, right? So the Bournemouth players are bitching at the referee, going,
allegedly,
you're making all these shitty decisions. That's why we're in the relegation zone. He goes, no, you're in the relegation zone because you're not playing very well. It's your responsibility, right? Calmly, he says that. That's what seems to have happened.
Yeah, so you put a bit of meat on the bone.
Oh, I can't believe that the referee is saying this to us. You're like, hang on a second here now. This is one of the worst things I've ever heard any professional footballer bitch and whine and moan about. Right?
Oh, I agree with you. I thought you were going to take the opposite approach, Jay. No, I agree with you 100%. I was embarrassed, to be honest with you, when I heard it was pitched at me last night. I hadn't heard of it. I don't know what else to say. It was so weak. It was a bit of a window, Kieran, in terms of the dressing room, that Bournemouth dressing room at the moment, and the management team as well. Yep. If they're trying to kind of use this to kind of rally the troops behind something, like, you know what I mean? And it seems almost an act of desperation. I'd be actually worried, somebody around the football club as a support, reading this, thinking, listen, lads, is this it? We're really clutching if this is all we've got.
Were you one for bitching at referees?
No, I said it last night. I don't remember. No, generally, I wasn't. No.
Did you have conversations with them? Would you be like an arm on the shoulder here? Ah, ref, come on now, look.
I wasn't even one for involving myself too much with
Your man's very fast. It's not fair. What am I supposed to do?
there was plenty of those conversations.
When you're at the bottom, though, you can feel like when you're so desperate for everything to go your way, you can feel like that everybody's against us or... You're with a big club and they get a penalty and it was kind of soft and you're like, we need that at the other end, not them. And does that build up over games to where it gets to the point where players are like...
Yeah, but it generally just manifests itself in a little kind of mini explosion, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, come on, that's fine,
right?
That's it.
Yeah.
That's
a one-off. But then to go to the press afterwards and go, this guy was giving out to us about, come on.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
And referees, you know, we're constantly bemoaning the fact referees like very robotic in their approach. This has traditionally always been the case. You know what I mean? They're distanced. They don't want to know players. They don't want to know. They think they're holier than hell. They're better than us. You can't approach them. You can't even talk to them. They're not human beings. They're aliens. They're not one of us. And then when a referee actually turns around and has actually engages with players, albeit in a slightly sarcastic, humorous way, then suddenly it's kind of thrown back at them. And you can bet your bottom dollar Mike Riley will be sitting down with John Moss over the next couple of days saying, John, look, you've got
enough.
John, you've left yourself a little bit open here, and which is a shame, because for me, like, that kind of dialogue's not a bad thing. Like, you know, professional athletes, like, you know, we're men here, like, you know, I mean, to be screaming about that. And that, I hate that kind of, that, was it Dan Gosling, was it, or who was quoted? He said, John Moss said to me, I mean, what gets said on the football pitch should say, it can't be like quoting referees, even managed to go to the referee's room. I went in there and he said, and I think when you're betraying the confidence there, like, you know, if the referee takes you into his confidence and actually opens up and offers an opinion, or say, you know, if you immediately to walk outside and share that with the press outside, and I think it's poor.
And all those swear words that you used at me when you were like calling me every name under the sun, like, that's what the referees say back to him. Would you talk to referees in both sports, in basketball and in
GA? I would be normally kind of calm enough in my approach, but there is obviously times where frustration, unfortunately, boils over, and you do kind of, you know. But
what was the point of talking to them? What were you trying to do?
Oh, you're just trying to maybe kind of get them to watch for something, you know. Especially if you're an inside forward, you're very far away. And look, I know we probably talked about umpires already, you know, during early on in the week. But if you feel that they are not watching or whatever, you know, you're trying to get a ref that's 60 yards away to kind of be keeping an eye out at jersey pulling or whatever stops you making a run. You'd go about it that way, and then you might get to the point where they just boil over and you're after getting harassed around a few times. But, you know, if there was a basketball ref in when we were in a poor run with the Tigers back in the day, like, and like that, like, you know, I had a bit of a go off him, like, you know, and he said, shut up, Kieran, you're just not good enough. You know, and I kind of got a laugh out of it, and, you know, I didn't at the time. Like, at the time, I said, what do you mean? He's like, you're just not good enough. You're not good enough. And then I was kind of looking around going, I went back and put my knees on my shorts at the free throw line. I was like, Jesus Christ, he's fucking right. You know, we're not good enough at the moment. So,
back from that.
You know, but like that bit of, you know, and Pat McEnany was always great that way. Like, you know, he'd tell you, shut up.
Yeah.
Shut up, Kieran. And you'd be kind of like, I should shut up. You know, I had my go off him. But you could always, you're on about that approaching referee, that's all you want, is to be able to approach him. And I don't mind if someone tells me to be quiet or shut up. I'd actually prefer shut up than kind of a smart aleck, be quiet, I'm not listening to you here, or something kind of
or
polite.
Ignoring
I prefer to kind of, or the ignoring is where is the worst. And that's what I love in the rugby. And I love when I'm watching Aussie Rules, is the conversation, the respect.
The Aussie Rules are the same.
Unbelievable.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah,
I assumed Aussie Rules would be like effing.
No, there's no effing. They're mic'd up.
Right.
The refs are mic'd up, and there's huge...
Mic'd up cures the swearing.
It 100% does. And it puts onus on the referee to communicate that bit better. You remember that documentary that came out that time on
it was you were playing the final,
Yeah, the final against Dublin, and it was great because the level of communication, you know, I felt was up even higher than normal, maybe.
Yeah,
because
he
might have known that was going on. But I think if they knew all the time and the players knew, it'd be brilliant for the game, because, you know, I think the behaviour out of the Premiership guys is shocking, the way they speak to refs and the view, and you can see the language flying out of them, and they get away with it.
But there's language, but
we don't get away with
that,
which is rightly so, because you don't want I don't want my daughter or young fella in time looking at players absolutely cursing the life out of a referee. But I would love the over and back.
Yeah, anyway. I don't mind the industrial language. I don't name call them when it veers into you're a this or a that. Fair enough. But in terms of just general industrial language, as we term it, I've no problem with that. That's kind of a natural thing, to be honest with you, any kind of working environment. So I've no real problem with that. The kind of players I have, you see a lot of it now in the rugby, I think is quite topical. I heard a bit of conversation about Johnny Sexton the weekend in terms of like how vocal he is with referees, when it's a kind of almost like a calculated thing. And I can understand that with referees, just in terms of painting pictures in their head early in the game. Mm. Look, ref... Greg, but you got to watch out for him. or in terms of maybe something the opposition team's doing, or just be mindful of that, will you, ref? It's happening, you're going to see more of it. So just painting little pictures for them, just nudging them in a certain direction, just making them aware of certain things. So that's not a bad thing in some respects. That's kind of quite clever, and that'll be almost a conscious approach. But I think there are some players, and there's a few players out there who just like, Ashley Young was one of them. Thank God he's over in Inter Milan, he's got his move. Because he used to drive me absolutely mad. Any decision on the pitch, he was literally, whoosh, he's there. Now the players are there, in the referee's ears. Any kind of melee, any kind of contentious decision, they're there. They're around it. They're in the middle of it, pushing people apart, having a dialogue with the referee. It's like the armband thing. They feel as if superpowers, I've got to get in there and get myself involved. Ashley Young was probably the worst example of that. He used to drive me mad. At times, he's no business. Too much. If I was a referee, I'd be saying, actually, what are you doing here? You've no business. Just leave me alone. Almost annoying. Becoming like a little bit annoying. You know what I mean? Like
I think if he was mic'd up, you'd see that over a game. Over two games, you'd realise this is a pattern. And game three, the referee would come and say, the whole world knows what you're at. So
I don't think you could do it in
football.
In football.
I think
it's the way the as you said, this onslaught and that, FFF and just people at home, like, you can't.
That would die in week three, because Wayne Rooney
would go
home and
watch himself.
You're going
to have to go through 2 weeks of complaints into the TV.
Mute,
abuse and Fs and blinds.
At least we get an indication of what players are actually saying when it looks as if they're playing that harmonica, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Every time now, and it's like ridiculous stuff.
What would Ashley Young say? Did he have a go-to line or anything like that?
I don't know what he talks about, but just some. It's I think it's the captaincy thing a little bit, and you've probably had a little. But I noticed that when you get the armband, right, more responsibility to a certain extent, but to kind of involve yourself all the time. You're talking 40 yards away, whoosh, got to get myself there, I've got to get in between people.
Did the armband have that magical effect on you when you got it?
No, not at all. Like I said, I never used to get myself too involved in those type of things. I always felt as if, Maybe it was a bit of a conscious thing. I kind of leave the referee alone. Maybe on occasion, maybe there'd be a conversation. But it was never a shouting, screaming match. It might have been, ref, just be careful of that. That's the second time that. Are you on? Have you seen it? Even okay, ref, have you seen that?
Yeah.
Even if you didn't give the free kick. Oh, you saw it. That's all right.
For next time.
Yeah, exactly. You're all right. Fair enough.
Is it true, Kieran, that the Dubs have like the rule book memorised, so that if you overheard their conversation with a referee, it'd be like, excuse me, ref, that's infraction 2A, page 17 of the GAA rule book. That's some of the stories that has gone through the rumour mill.
Is it true, Kieran, that the Kerry Mafia has seized the airwaves once again here?
I think the Kerry Mafia have infiltrated there.
Thank you, it was actually a
fellow Leinster coach.
Are you making this up as you go along?
Is this a serious accusation you're making?
This is something that has actually been
heard. By a fellow Leinster.
It's certainly not Kerry.
Don't take the bait.
This is a true story. You're not just making this up. I thought you were joking.
No, I'm not joking. No,
this is one of your bits.
No, it's not.
No.
Like, obviously, I overegged it, but the way they speak to the referee is actually very calculated.
They
don't get wound up. They don't say, "What the hell are you doing, ref?" It's like, actually, for what particular infraction did I get done for there? And that is some of the language that they tend to use towards the referee.
Yeah, I think they're brilliant in the way they deal with the ref. They're always respectful. They know how far to push it. And you know, when I look back on the Kerry team in my early days, when we were successful, we were probably you could say that we weren't as good as they are at that. And I would say that was big into this whole culture and identity thing that they have. And
did that cost you in the Tyrone games then?
No, I wouldn't say cost us in Tyrone games. I wouldn't, you know, but I definitely think the refs would have a better opinion if you have a ref that ref our era versus this current Dublin team. I would say that if you had a ref in both eras, they would say, who's the better team to ref?
Yeah.
I think they'd all say this Dublin team, because, you know, they just have, they are good in the way they speak with them. And it is important, because it's, don't forget, it's human nature. We forget that. These guys are very human, and if you're in the bank and you're trying to deal with somebody and some fella's roaring at you behind the counter to F off, you're not going to want to go back into him again. You're going to wait for the nice person to get you in the queue. And that's almost like
a subconscious thing, is it? That sort of a person, you're like, you'll naturally gravitate towards, won't you? Not an obvious thing in terms of your like decision making, but almost not knowing it yourself. And invariably late in the game, a couple of those 50 decisions will have to be made. And I think that's where the players are hoping that'll kick in. You'll just, for some reason, subconsciously just side with one particular team over another, maybe for that reason that Kieran's talking about there.
There's new broadcast policies being devised by the GAA. That's part of the section of the Director General stuff yesterday. Should miking up referees be a part of the education of the entire country? And what would the players think about it? And should the GPA be in favour of it, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think it's a win-win all around. It's a win-win for the players. I think it's a win-win for the refs because people at home can understand what decisions they're making. And I think it's huge for the viewer. You know, the viewer that's watching the game is now getting a completely inside look into what's happening on the pitch.
Yeah.
And there's massive onus, as you said, there's massive onus get shared around to for people to, you know, speak to them the way the Johnny Sexton's approach, you know, the ref every week in the rugby. And, you know, people said he talked too much last week and I heard it on the coverage of the game, but I thought Johnny was good last week. You know,
excellent.
I thought he was brilliant. I thought he was in at the right time, a right level of calmness, but he was assertive in what he was saying. And the biggest thing you said earlier on is that's exactly what you're doing, is marking his card for the next time.
Yeah.
You might have missed it there, but I'm telling you, this is going on. And all that does is the next time there's that instance, he's looking now for that thing that's going on. Whereas if you come in roaring and shouting the head off him,
which definitely.
I'm guilty of at times, it doesn't get you anywhere.
Go on.
I was just going to say, I'm not convinced it'd work on the football pitch, so I've got to be honest with you. And I don't think necessarily a lot of referees would be in favour of it, having to publicly explain yourself in terms of the reasoning behind the decision that you've just... I think actually that puts a huge amount more pressure on the shoulders, makes it even more self-conscious, I think, having to verbally explain all your decisions, not just to the players in front of you, but to the viewing public, everybody in the crowd, the millions of people watching.
I think that
invites a huge amount of pressure as well.
Most of the decisions are actually obvious. Most of them are like pull, I saw pull, I saw trip, clash, you know. I think it's fairly obvious. I think over a period of time, they would just get used to it. There'd be a generation who would find it difficult to referees, and the next generation would just be like, this is what happens. In every sport where it happens, it's worked really well. It works really well in American football. It works really well in rugby. It works really well to explain to people who are supporters, either paying to go to it or in many cases paying to watch it on TV, why they're seeing what they're seeing. I think we should trial it, Kenny. Would you go that far?
Yeah, just like VAR. Huge success we've had off the base is trialing VAR.
Just screwed up VAR doesn't mean anything to screw this up. Right, 7:48 this morning, time for me to tell you the sports news from overnight. The GPA have called intercounty games a revenue generating machine as they reacted strongly to the GAA's annual report. GAA Director General Tom Ryan said that the near €30 million spent on preparing and fielding intercounty teams was unsustainable, but the chief executive of the Players Association, Paul Flynn, has said such claims paint intercounty players as the GAA's problem child. It's a very long, detailed statement saying that intercounty fixtures generate a total economic impact of €390 million annually, supporting 3,600 jobs and directly contributing over €40 million to the exchequer. This at a time when many of our players can barely make ends meet and in many cases cannot. A strong statement from the GPA overnight. We might talk about that a little bit later on as well. Heartbreak for Carlow IT. 14-man UCC came from behind to retain the Electric Ireland Fitzgibbon Cup last night. They were 4 points down at the break and they also had Niall O'Leary sent off in the second half, but they ran out 18 points to 2-11 winners at the DCU Sports Ground, so a one-point win. Shane Conway from Kerry scored 9 points for UCC, so a big night for him. The complexion of this season's SSE Electricity First Division final against Certainty last night. Shamrock Rovers 2 were granted a licence after Limerick backed out of the process. The Rovers reserve side take the place of Limerick, who were initially denied a licence due to financial issues in December. West Brom 6 points clear at the top of the championship last night, a 2-1 win at Reading. Fulham missed the chance to go second in the table. They were held to a 1-1 draw away to Millwall. Republic of Ireland midfielder Alan Brown scored for Preston, who stay in the playoff spots with a 2-0 win at Stoke. James Collins scored the only goal as Luton beat Sheffield Wednesday 1-0. Bristol City survived a late derby rally to win 3-2 at Ashton Gate. Cardiff kept alive their playoff ambitions with a 3-0 win at Huddersfield. Celtic beat Hearts 5-0, opening up a 10-point lead at the top of the SPL as Rangers lost 2-1 at Kilmarnock. And in golf, Rory McIlroy tees off as world number one for the very first time in nearly 5 years today. He's grouped with DJ and Patrick Cantlay for the opening round of the Genesis Open on the USPGA Tour in Los Angeles. We'll bring you Virtual Insanity with John Duggan at 9 o'clock here this morning on OTBA. And here's what's coming up. Top five stories coming your way at 8 o'clock. Going to do the papers next. Shot Clock with Kieran at 20 past 8. Sports News at 8:45 with Tom Malone. Virtual Insanity at 8:55. And Brian O'Driscoll coming your way at 10 past 9 this morning. Time for the papers. OTB AM. So this is the main story in the back of the Irish Independent this morning. Intercounty players are not the GAA's problem child, insists the GPA. The GPA pointed out they want to build towards a modern form of sustainable amateurism, and the GPA members through intercounty games help generate a vast percentage of the record revenue. So what happens is the Director General comes out and says the coffers are good, and they really are. There's been a surge in revenue, record-breaking figures for them, and yet the GPA are still on the same deal that they were on the previous year, Kieran, when revenue wasn't as big, and GPA are like, we generate, our members generate the vast majority of this through the big games that everybody wants to be associated with from a sponsorship and a broadcast point of view and paying through the turnstiles to go and see, and yet our share of the pie has gone down, even though you're making more money. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about that. So what do you think about this?
I think that it's the GAA's outlook on it last night was detailed. It was good. I listened to Paul talking about it last night, and I think, you know, he's GPA. Of course, it's kind of almost like the thing we dealt with last week with Basketball Ireland, kind of coming out on the back of the FAI, being kind of, I think it's a good time to kind of strike, because, you know, they do want more, the GPA, and they do probably deserve more. And you know, if you're going to come out and talk about big profits in revenue in the year, I think Paul Flynn and his team have every right to say, it's great to say that you've all these profits, but let's call a spade a spade. It's coming a lot from the intercounty game. And, you know, I always talk about that as well, and I'm glad they put a number on it, but the actual revenue it brings to towns and, you know, Killarney and Munster final day is absolutely like the local economy is on fire over it. Yeah, like, you know, the amount of money, the hotels, the bars, everything makes is huge. So it's nice to see what's been brought to the Exchequer as well. But, you know, I think it is the time to strike, and coming off the back of announcing huge profits, of course, the GPA need to look for more for their members.
Can I make a point on this? And I meant to make it yesterday when Paul Rice was in studio with us yesterday. That the 30 million figure that's quoted, and Paul Wright's making the point, loads more is spent, that's kind of off books, yes, that you never actually see. That one of the ways that you can control the expenditure is if you control the amount of time that players spend training. If you have fewer training sessions, then you actually have to spend fewer amounts of money on your physio and all the things that you travel, for example. And one way of doing that is making sure that the players self-report that you're not being overtrained, exactly the way they do in the NFL. So in the collective bargaining agreement, in all those sports, there's a limit on the contact hours that you're allowed to have with a team. So everybody has the same. It's the same playing field, right? Now, it's difficult to do in GAA because obviously players have to travel. The Mayo lads, are their contact hours included in the travel? You need to come to some arrangement with that, right? But the GPA need to be part of the solution to the overspending on the teams. They need to be involved in those conversations, as opposed to the intercounty game is a juggernaut and it's untamable. Unless everybody sits around and goes, okay, we can come to an arrangement on this where we all feel like that 30 million is too much, that it like small counties are spending too much. Big counties can afford it. So Tipperary can obviously afford to spend as much as they want because they've generated loads of money through their fundraising committees. There's an opportunity here to get everybody involved and have a collective shared responsibility for not spending too much on the teams, but spending the right amounts in the right places. Is that a fair point?
It is. It's hard to police, you know. We have a month off that teams aren't supposed to be training, and that's impossible to, you know, it's...
The players would have to be involved.
Yeah, the players
would
have
to... blow the whistle. The GPA...
It all comes down to fixtures, though. The first thing you said, yes, is the fixtures. Yes. And both the GPA and the CPA have both said that fixtures, it's the major bone of contention. And Tom Ryan did look at that and say fixtures has to be addressed and we have to get a calendar year. That's how it's fixed. And you're right in what you say about there has to be more game. Like, there has to be more games versus the amount of training you do now for games in the GAA is off the Richter. And, you know, they say we can't play every week in a row. Can we play every week in a row for not doing half the training? You know, do we do what the NFL or the AFL do and have a big block of pre-season, a 6-week block of pre-season where you get your fitness and all that stuff up to date, and then you're just playing games and maintaining from there on in,
yeah,
minding yourself during the week rather than trying to play Sunday, get a hard training Tuesday, wind down Thursday, meeting Friday, game Saturday, hard training Tuesday, wind down Thursday, meeting Friday, travel somewhere for a game on the following Sunday. It's too much. So, but the fixtures is the biggest issue, I think for the GAA, the GPA and the CPA, and everybody has the involvement on how to get this fixed. But that's the crucial thing. I think you can tackle all your other issues once you have a set defined calendar year.
Yeah, and I think that they can all be part of the same solution.
Yes.
My final point on this is that you make a good point about the training, right? So the smaller counties are going to feel like they need to spend more to try and bridge the gap. But actually what you could do is you could have a centralised fund to pay for strength and conditioning, and the same strength and conditioning coaching teams could work with a bunch of different inter-county sites, or could work for that whole county. Like, there's loads of ways around this, and that could be monitored centrally, so that your 30 million suddenly, we've got one professor of strength and conditioning who does three teams in Connacht, and somebody else does three other teams. Like, there's ways around this if you're creative and clever about it.
Yeah,
I would think though, like, I take your point. It's in getting that kind of level playing field, and in terms of say sports science, physical conditioning, have physios, you have people like your Dottenham people around the country, different counties. But would that not a bit of a conflict then arise? I mean, these people have access to a lot of information, private and personal information on individual players, the team generally, fitness statistics, this, that, and the other. You know, you wouldn't want that compromise. I'd imagine any kind of county would be very sensitive in terms of keeping that information in house and having somebody here they can absolutely trust. He's one of theirs. He may not be an actual coach of sorts. He might be the physical conditioning coach, but those people are huge now around the teams.
Well, so maybe
he's got to be one of us. We've got to trust him with all that information.
Maybe the top counties do that. But if you had the same strength and conditioning team working for Carlo, Leash, Wicklow, and
I like the
for
principle,
example, right?
Yeah.
Then, like, they're professionals. They sign up to a charter that they're not going to share any data. But everybody's getting, like, essentially the science is the same. Get people fit and maintain them, right? Do individualized programs. Measure certain key things. Like, it's not that hard.
If there's a
will, there's a way.
Where there's a will, there's a way. Look, and I agree what you're saying in principle, but I don't agree with you that certain guys can be involved in a few different teams. It's the paranoia levels are extremely high in the GAA anyway. Fellas can't say boo because they're afraid that something is going to get out about somebody else. So having guys that are going to be in every dressing room and testing guys and with all the will in the world, you get them to sign something that they're not going to say anything, and they come back up and say, Janie Mac, the boys are in Raggard or below compared to A, B and C. Next thing that gets back, it's just...
There's certainly some shared... Maybe it's more logistics then. Maybe it's not just strength and conditioning. Or maybe it's base strength and conditioning. I don't know. I just think there's ways to do this that prevent the Wild West scenario we have at the moment, where individual counties are paying people sometimes you don't even have the right credentials across the country. Anyway, what have you got?
Irish Examiner this morning leads with Fitzgibbon Cup final. Mastering adversity is the headline. UCC dig deep to claim 40th Fitzgibbon Cup crown. CIT return to the top table. Tommy Martin asks, could time be running out for the cult of Messi and keeping players down? Intercounty is not the GAA's problem child.
The Irish Sun back page is Wahey Jude. Chelsea and Man United fight to pay record 50 million for 16-year-old. This is Birmingham Alert. So Chelsea have entered a 50 million battle with Man United to sign whiz kid Jude Bellingham. The Birmingham A16 is being watched by all of Europe's top clubs, including Real Madrid and Barcelona. 50 million for a 16-year-old.
I'd be very surprised if that's up top, you know, over the course of...
35 million plus 15 in add-ons.
It's a huge amount. See, I've heard his name mentioned a couple of times and a couple of... Brum lads have mentioned him in terms of this lack of play, but I didn't realise he was that sought after, I must admit.
Fun money though. It is fun money these days, like 50 million isn't what it used to be. I heard Gerard was on with Gary Neville on Soccer Box last week, and he was saying that time that it was 30 million, 32 million that Chelsea were trying to buy him from Liverpool for.
But this
that
is
was
massive
huge money at the time.
But 16 in terms of his development, even on a personal level that he needs to go through between now and 2021, that's massive. Say the likes of Say Sancho, for an example, 19 years of age at Dortmund, talking about him 100 million, but you can see it. You know, the level that he's at the moment, kind of in terms of goals, assists, quality performances week in, week out, much smaller risk. 16 years of age, in terms of potentially the drop off there. I played with a lad at Wimbledon, probably as good as I've played with 17 years of age. He probably would have been in a similar bracket, I'd imagine, to this young fella. His problem was just injuries. Picked up a couple of injuries, 17, 18, and never got back to the level. So I mean, that's a huge investment considering the kind of potential pitfalls that could be heading down the bumps in the road for that young fellow over the next couple of years.
He could be a Rooney, like. The Herald Sport, Premier return aim for Patch. Obviously, United is the place he has to go and probably will go. And Cooper hails Dubs' resolve, so ability to cope with adversity, big focus for teams, says Johnny, which was again proven by Dublin last week.
Johnny Cooper is really good. He was on obviously his show last night as well. Really interesting stuff about his conversations with Owen Farrell and Owen Farrell's interest in the GAA. Obviously, his brother playing with Clonagale, and obviously his father living in Ireland, and the link he has there.
His little brother's playing with Ringsend, Clonagale and Ringsend.
So that's kind of the shared interest that they had. Just how interested Johnny Cooper is in all these different facets of life and how he actually manages to channel that into how he plays. Like, it's very interesting when Joe was like to him in the interview last night, what do you enjoy the most about Gaelic football? And he's like, putting in all the research and then actually executing that research on the pitch in a very sort of academic way. He looks at the art of being a cornerback. That even like mentions watching the O'Shea's and perhaps not having enough camera angles to see where did the defender actually come from, because obviously he's thinking to himself, I want to be in their starting position. Like, do I run the ball from behind or in front of the man when the opposition are attacking? So he's got it down to a fine art. It's a great interview for anybody who's interested.
Yeah, we aired that live exclusively on OTB Sports Radio yesterday from 2 to 3 o'clock. Best place to get sports radio is on the Go Loud app, which you can download from the Play Store. The back page of the Daily Star, perfect 10. Celts surge clear as Jers are killed off. That's a Scottish Premiership story. Cork cash in on Sean for license. So Cork City sold their sell-on clause for Sean Maguire to Preston North End to meet stringent FAI club licensing demands. And Igalo is told to stay away. This is the biggest news in shot clock history, because we've got the over-under on how many goals Odion Igalo is going to score. Premier League goals, obviously, we had to specify, right? And it was 4.5, was it?
4.5 was the over-under.
I picked the under, and I'm like, quids in already.
Yeah,
Kieran's screwed.
I'm going to call foul against that if it boils down, this lad doesn't play a game.
He's in quarantine.
That's amazing, isn't it? I mean, it's not. Oh no, you couldn't have seen this thing coming, really. Like, you know, when it was out there, wasn't it? The story was breaking, and it wasn't a big consideration.
Yeah.
Like the fact that nobody would in there. Now, easy in hindsight, the Manchester United boardroom was thinking, "Oh, potentially we've got to be careful. This could be an issue." Like, I mean, the problem. Problem's grown, isn't it? It's getting bigger in terms of the coronavirus. Like, and he's obviously been at the eye of the storm, isn't it?
He could get a few tips from Jose Mourinho about being quarantined in the Lowry Hotel.
I was practicing that one all morning. Stay away. This is exclusive, but it's not really exclusive. Shock for Man United star Igalo banned from training ground over coronavirus fears. It's only 2 weeks. The 2 weeks must be nearly up anyway. So. He'll be there soon enough. And
when was Pogba diagnosed with it? Because he's been a...
Gosling, ref Moss mocked us. You're in relegation zone. Again, an exclusive that's in all the papers, according to the Mirror. Bournemouth have been stunned by the Premier League's decision to back referee John Moss after Dan Gosling claimed he had mocked the club's top flight position. Look, I mean, Gosling...
I've never heard a player mock. Players don't mock professional footballers. I wish we could mock. Flag off, maybe.
Right, the Times of London. United play signing Igalo in quarantine. And player accuses Sarky ref and Chelsea to get 33 million Zayek. So so they're signing the Ajax player for 33 million plus bonuses. And that is expected to happen this weekend. And then just very briefly, there's a double page spread of an interview with Paul Carrington talking about the Ryder Cup ahead of the golf this weekend. We'll get into that a little bit later on with John Duggan.
Back page of the Irish Daily Mail, it's a photograph of Jennifer Hanrahan in the long jump. Big night in AIT last night at the International Grand Prix. Thomas Barr there in set, setting a personal best last night. Rory ready to put in hard work to stay number one is their headline on the golf. But their main story, GPA lash out. We are not the problem child, fumes Flynn. Also, inside the Irish Daily Mail this morning, there's a two-page spread by Ian Herbert, The Invisible Men, with a picture of the three Glazer brothers, and they've conveniently put down their distance from Manchester. Joel Glazer, residence Tampa, Florida, distance from Manchester, 4,229 miles. Avram Glazer, 4,497 miles. And Brian Glazer, 4,299 miles. So any Manchester United fans out there wondering how far away they are geographically from Manchester, that's where they are. The Daily Telegraph goes with a couple of pages on this story this morning. Suicide, a sporting tragedy. Stark warning over mental health problems in elite sport, specifically in Olympic sports, it seems. Putting all your hopes and expectations on one event over a four-year period and the pitfalls it can have for your mental health. Back page of The Guardian, then a setback for UK athletics as BBC balks at new £3 million rights deal. BBC are interested in buying athletics rights, but they wanted at a very much a cut-down price. It's cricket is their main story. Lungi Ngidi roaring with delight after taking the wicket of Moeen Ali to set up South Africa's dramatic one-run victory over England in the first T20 international in East London.
The front page of the Irish Times this morning, Van Dijk signing the most influential. It's a picture of Virgil van Dijk celebrating a goal and saying the defender would not only walk into any team in the world, he would improve it. Is this all part of the debate about Jordan Henderson being Footballer of the Year? Van Dijk is Footballer of the Year, right? Again.
I don't know about that. I think the momentum behind Jordan Henderson is a pretty important thing. Because
it's a runaway train.
Like, that can happen in this award.
It can, but it's not the correct decision. Who's your
opinion, isn't it? Obviously, in your opinion, it's not, but...
Yeah. Do you think Jordan Henderson is Footballer of the Year?
I think it's Sadio Mane, I would have thought.
Could easily, but I think there's...
Who would you vote for as a player?
I think there's four or five of Liverpool players... I think it's the first time in a long time you could actually, that list of players for the Players' Player of the Year, you could strongly argue...
From one club?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Five to six of them, all being Liverpool players. You could put...
Power rank them for me. Come on, give me who... So you're sitting there, PRS TV.
They're obvious, aren't they? Van Dijk.
But what's the order? What's your order?
Henderson. I could put Firmino, Mane and the two fullbacks. You could easily put them. You could even mention the goalkeeper.
Henderson's been backed way into this thing. I looked
Big
at
date or something.
Yeah, I looked at it a couple of weeks ago and Mane was favoured with Henderson around third. Henderson is 5-4 on at the moment. Sadio Mane 3-1 second favourite. So this is done.
It's almost as if all the players are voting and betting at the same time.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Obviously, they don't bet.
So early in the year, like there's a good
it
bit
does
to go,
fluctuate like. So quickly off the back of it. Like Sterling made a point. Sterling, like a month ago, it would have been in there, the top six, wouldn't he? And me, absolutely, wouldn't even have been discussion about it. He's had a drop off in terms of performance-wise and goals, and he's not even in the discussion now.
I think Giles, he had Andy Robertson as his...
That's what I'm saying, yeah. I think he'd make an argument for any of those Liverpool players.
Come on, who's yours? I've given you a vote.
I would give the Henderson boy a whisker.
Would you?
I think there's other players outside. I think Vardy comes into the equation. I think Danny Ings to a certain extent. Grealish, for me, I think it's a strong argument made for him. People just don't give enough consideration to players, especially young players. His level of performance in his struggling team as well.
Sensational.
They've been really dipped. Yep. You know, they've been all over the place, but he's turned up every week in terms of.
Are you just trying to win back the love of the Liverpool fans that you lost with Bobby, with the, not Firmino.
Fabinho
stuff.
I've had a few grovelling apologies of Liverpool fans about that. I don't want to blow my own trumpet, but I rest my case. But no, I think the Grealish one for me is an intro. He probably won't get a mention. But Grealish is massive for me. I've watched a lot of him this year. And that young fella now for me almost stands alone in terms of football and ability, in terms of what's out there. You could compare him with Maddison, a couple of other players in terms of technical ability and football ability. But his ability to get the ball even like and travel at people and go past people, like dribbling.
He's the most forward player, isn't
dynamic.
He?
Yeah, just in terms of turning his speed over 5-10 yards to get away from people, as well as having the ability to break the lines with his pass and little combination play, is actually remarkable. I think he actually does not know to like him at the moment. I'd say maybe Foden at Manchester City. I've seen glimpses of it in him. Jack Wilshere was the last player that I saw with that ability to travel with the ball, commit people and actually go past, as long as I was all those other things. So for me, he's the one. A lot of talking this summer. There's going to be some big transfers in the summer. A lot of the top four are going to be chasing a lot of Sancho and one or two others. But he's the one for me. And I look at Manchester United. If there's one player I think they've got to go and get, it's him. Because he, from a creative point of view, for me, he's the one who can actually transform that Manchester United.
Where do you play him? What position does he play?
Well, this is the beauty of him. You can play him. He's played like left of a three for Aston Villa. You can play him as a 10, just off a single striker. Or you can play him in a three, those two advanced number eights in a midfield three. You can play him. He's that good, because he goes and influences.
And what's going to be the best for Man United?
Well, that's what I'm saying. So if Solskjaer stays there, a new manager comes in, and say he wants to play more of a traditional 4-4-1-1, then you play him off the front, and that number 10 just off.
Well, behind Rashford.
Rashford, whoever that is, another centre forward's coming in, or whoever it is, Martial, you can talk that one around. So you can play in that position. Or if you've got playing midfield three, that kind of V shape, which they have done, with a holding midfield player and two number eights, as Liverpool do, you can play him either those number eight positions, or even at a push off the flanks, left or right. But really, I just feel as if the last year I've looked at him and thought, wow, this kid's, I knew he was good, but he's actually getting better and better.
This is the sorry state of modern football, Kenny. Jack Grealish is 100-1 to win PFA Footballer of the Year. Fabinho, 50-1. Disgrace, isn't it?
You're trying to warm me up. Look, I've never talked down Fabinho. I'm a fan of the player, but you know I've got a preference for Henderson and that kind of deep midfield position. But Grealish, for a fit for what Manchester United need, and I'm sure he'd be linked with Manchester City and one or two others, but in terms of what Manchester United need, with Pogba going out the door, for me, I take Grealish ahead of Pogba now. If I get Pogba out for 100 million and pay 100 million, I'll take both. Pogba's that type of player, actually, that I'm talking about. He could be that player, but his heart's not in it, clearly. His head's gone. He's practically out the door mentally anyway. So he's got to go. So for me, you get 100 million for a Pogba, immediately you write the £100 million cheque to Aston Villa to get Grealish in the door, and straight away you're in a better place.
Okay. Do we have an Irish news this morning? We do. McAvoy, responsibility for casement shortfall lies with government. So this is the continuing debate and saga of the wreck that is Casement Park. The GAA confirmed that they wouldn't be committing any extra funding to the redevelopment of Casement Park than the original figure that they had a couple of years ago. But hopefully now, finally, there's a government in the north. We might begin to see some movement on that. And do we have offthewall.com? No, we don't. We'll check out that yourselves and see what's leading the way there. Now, a reminder, on the 17th of February, that's just 4 days away from now, that's next Monday, some of the best football pundits in the country are going to be on hand to talk through the upcoming Champions League second round fixtures. Brian Kerr, Damien Delaney, Keith Andrews and European Cup winning legend Graeme Souness are going to be in attendance at the Alex Hotel in Dublin. It's all with thanks to Virgin Media Sport, which now has over 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games all live this season, with these games being available to all Virgin Media TV customers. Head over to offthewall.com/events to register for tickets. 12 minutes past 8 this morning. A brilliant show for you lined up here on OTBAM. Kieran Kenny in studio. The shot clock coming your way at 20 past 8. Our full chat with Brian O'Driscoll coming your way after 9 o'clock this morning as well. We did air our interview with Brian live exclusively on OTB Sports Radio yesterday from 2 o'clock to 3. So if you've already downloaded the Go Loud app and chosen Off The Ball as your station, or you're tuned into offtheball.com/radio, then you got to hear Brian O'Driscoll first. You can also listen to OTB AM every morning on OTB Sports Radio. It's a fully dedicated sports radio station right here on Off The Ball. Now, here's a taste of that conversation with Brian, answering the all-important question, is the dog back in the Irish team? OTB
AM. I think there's... Yeah, there looked like there was a nastiness in some players. I think Tadhg Furlong is a guy that looks as though he's playing to prove a point. You have to remember, he'd... quiet enough World Cup. Andrew Porter got selected for the Northampton game away from home, and Furlong was benched. And sometimes that works, in a coach's favour, where they've got two players, similar enough quality, vying for the same position, and you bench one for a while. It's just a small little reminder that we can live without you, particularly how well Porter was playing. But I think since then, Furlong, I've been very impressed with him the last two weekends. His work rate, the appetite in defence, kick chase, things that you wouldn't associate someone driving from a tight head position.
Yeah.
The last play of the game against Scotland, the amount of moments he had in that, working hard where it looked as though he had cramp and playing through it. I was really, really impressed with him. And he looks as though he's carrying super hard with a lot of aggression. And maybe we don't need that level of Sean O'Brien. And I'm not saying that things were taken out of context in that. I'm not saying that some of those players don't possess any aggressiveness, but I just don't think there's a Sean O'Brien there.
Well, what do you mean, like as in bending the rules a little bit? Or?
Not even that. I just thought everything he did was so confrontational.
Okay.
Everything. And the players that have played with him will understand that more than anything. That it just, he demanded so much every time. You knew that it was 100 miles an hour and that he never, ever took an easy option. If he could carry, I never saw him carry at 90, or 99%. It was 100% every time. Same with every shot. And it's a mentality. And I think they're quite that type of player is quite unique. You don't get them every generation. I think you get, or you might get a couple every generation. And I think comparatively, if you were to ask, I'm sure no one likes reading that, there's question, there's dog in them. But I don't think, I stand by, I don't think any of those players are of that Sean O'Brien ilk of dog or being an on-field tug.
Can they become that player?
I think it's probably built in you or not. I think it's really a mentality. And listen, there's guys, I think CJ Stander, the aggressiveness that he is playing with and hitting with is hugely admirable at the moment. I think he's a key component. Obviously, he's gotten two man of the matches, so without stating the obvious, but I read an article that talked about him being constantly questioned. I would absolutely love him to develop an offloading game, because if he can, he will be unplayable. I just don't feel as though he looks as though he's going to get the ball out of contact. And there's lots of chances to do it, because he's got such aggression to get beyond the tackle where he can turn his body and actually get it away. It just feels as though sometimes he's looking for another yard himself, rather than realising the work is done there, the defence is scrambling, now look for the offload. And if he can do that, I think he will be a real standout performer in the Six Nations for this Irish team for the next few years.
We are out of time, Brian, but you did say a player who expects the most from their teammates, and I can't leave you go without asking about Sexton, and I guess that element of his character that often comes out, but now what we're seeing is a dialogue to Johnny Sexton because he's Ireland captain. What did he make of his interactions with Roman Pott on Saturday?
Yeah, I think at times you could understand why he came in a little bit frustrated at one or two decisions. Looking back in the video, I think from both sides' perspectives, there were a couple of questionable ruck calls. It seems sometimes it's a bit of a free-for-all under Pott. But I thought Johnny, he grew into the game, although he got better in the second half. Johnny Wilkinson made a really good point. Maybe the time to go harder at the referee is when you've scored rather than when the opposition have scored. I think sometimes you have to take your foot off and accept that they've got a bit of momentum there, and there's no point in antagonising the referee because it's almost reinforcing that he thinks that team is in the ascendancy.
Okay.
When you get frustrated and get annoyed. So sometimes, that's a time to let something go. And Johnny will learn that with time, of understanding you can't have a go every time you're annoyed. You've got to pick your moments. You've got to pick your battles. And there was, there was a few things that you look back and there's sliding doors moments where I think there was a penalty on 5 minutes into the second half and he got two penalty options, one on the touchline and one around the 15, and it was a 12-7 game. You knock that over, it's a two-score game. But yeah, he went to the more difficult penalty in the corner.
Van der Veer
scored the try. But I think don't run the risk. You've got to score a line out. You've got to make sure that the line out maul is good enough. And
Absolutely.
Even in hindsight. 8-point game. 2 scores is where you want to get to. There's a security that comes with 2 scores. It doesn't matter how it comes. So it gets to, I think he knocked over the conversion. So it's 19-7. That's a 12-point game. But that's still 2 scores.
Mm.
So granted, it's a try and two tries and a conversion, but the way Ireland were defending, that's a difficult line to break. There were, the discipline was only okay, but I just think those sort of things, because there was a try, no one will ever talk about it. But I think they're things that you just always have to look back and kind of wonder, should I have done that in that time? I personally would have kicked it goal, definitely.
Yeah, and I'm sure he's being super critical of all the decisions and the coaching staff are this week as well.
Well, we're scrutinising all the negative. There was positive things where he got besides the way he played the game, his defensive moments, but quiet things that we probably didn't hear him saying to Romain Poit that we're oblivious to, that helped us get into the game or helped him build his relationship with Poit. So I think he's doing okay. But listen, we're on radio here to pick holes, aren't we?
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
The
question ultimately is, you know, where do we go from here? I mean, where do we go from here?
OTB Sports Radio.
I drunk texted Joe Smith, too small Latin a Hebra. And he obviously just threw it into like Google Translate or something, because he's like, ha, thanks, Danny. Yeah, the first half was good, actually.
Now broadcasting 24 hours a day, live on the Go Loud app, Alexa.
You have a whole new world of possibilities.
Google Home, tune in, and offtheball.com/radio.
This is OTB Sports Radio.
OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Find the perfect gift this Valentine's Day.
Yeah, you're very welcome back to OTB AM this morning. 21 minutes past 8. Top 5 stories that we're covering for you this morning. Odiana Gallo is in quarantine at the moment. She'll be coming out anytime soon over fears of the coronavirus following his time in China. The GPA have reacted strongly to the publication of the Director General's annual report yesterday. We talked a bit about that with Kieran Donnelly a little bit earlier on as well. The Glazers, where are they? Well, they're in Tampa. Is that what that story is?
It's 15 years since the Glazer takeover. So that's kind of sparked the Mail to do a piece on it. I just found it very amusing that they've put down the exact number of kilometres that they're from Manchester.
It's pretty weak, though.
Too long, didn't read. They're ages away and ages and ages and ages away, and they've got no interest.
I think they're probably so rich that they have multiple homes. Do you know, they're like billionaires, so they might have a home in Florida where it's sunny. They might also have a base York and LA and London. And
so the Fenway Group, not they're not based predominantly in the East Coast of America either. Like, have we got the mileage for the Fenway Group to get to Liverpool?
Well, what's
the argument's pretty weak, isn't it? I'd have a bigger problem.
All I'm doing is stating facts.
I've no problem with the amount of time they spend away from the football club. The biggest issue for me was how they actually run the football club. And what actually sticks in my gut, and I'm not even a Manchester United supporter, is that once a year when they release kind of financial statements and it becomes obvious that big chunk of money which they actually take out of Manchester United's account, like 10, 20, 30, 50 million, which they just write themselves a cheque for and deposit in their own personal account back in the United States.
However,
that's got to be the absolute killer.
I'm sure, except that they've spent loads of money. The Man United's wage bill is big enough for them to be competitive.
I'll give you that, yeah. But they've mortgaged that club to the hilt. Now, I know the club is worth a huge amount of money, but that still doesn't sit right with me. I look at the comparison in terms of like Manchester City and other clubs, people coming in and putting their money actually on the table. Even Mike Ashley came into Newcastle United Football Club, 100, 120 million debt on the books of the football club straight away, whoosh, wiped away the debt, right off we go. Yeah, he's not spending a huge amount of money, but I have a lot more respect for him actually doing that rather than the Glazers coming in and saying, yeah, we're going to buy the football club, but we're going to borrow a huge amount of money.
So they did do that, right? And I can see why people have an issue with that, and I totally understand that. However, the other thing is that they have backed successive managers in the transfer market. They have spent money on players and their wage bill is astronomical. It has just been badly spent and badly managed by the hierarchy of the club.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not their money, is it? The revenues that they're generating, sponsorship.
How does that matter?
But small things matter to me. And the fact they're prepared, it's like hands in the till. The fact they're prepared, but every year they put the hand in there and grab that. My saying a reasonably insignificant amount of money in comparison to what the club's worth, billion or whatever it is. But to take that money every year, every single year, 10, 20 million a year, thank you very much, we'll have some of that. That worries me. That doesn't sit right with me.
There's a couple of interesting points in this article. I think Ian Herbert kind of paints a picture here where we're not always right to just point a finger at Ed Woodward and say, you are the bad guy, you have screwed up this club completely. Like it says, the Glazers' decision to allow Ferguson and Gill, the brains trust of Manchester United, to leave in the same summer said everything about what happens when owners are semi-detached. If Woodward had operated with Ferguson for a few years, the outcome may have been very different.
I mean, like, who knows? No,
he says, for Woodward's Radamel Falcao, read Gill and Ferguson's Calamitous Bebe.
Granny had balls, you'd be your granddad.
Then finally, this is actually a very valid point. Now is the point of greatest opportunity to install a director of football. There will not be the kind of opposition from Solskjaer that a signature managerial appointee like Mauricio Pochettino would present in a quest for power and authority. Which is true, if you want to do anything with the club, within the hierarchy, like installing a director of football, now was the time to do it, because Solskjaer would be like, all right, that's grand, I'll let it happen. Whereas Mauricio Pochettino may actually turn around and say, no.
No, I don't think so. I think that's wrong. I think Pochettino in particular understands how the game operates. I think managers generally now have very acceptance of a director of football and actually would engage with that type of person, would actually complement what I do and would actually be a help to me rather than a hindrance. Yes, the likes of Pochettino would go in there and be pretty adamant in terms of, well, look, I have a strong say in terms of recruitment, who comes in. But ultimately, in the modern game, you've got to work with these people, directors of football.
Yeah, Jurgen Klopp works with the transfer committee, the same transfer committee that got completely derided under the previous regime. Look, I think that you can't but blame Woodward for what's happened. That if there should have been a director of football, he should have appointed one, because that's his job. He walks into whoever the manager and says, we're getting this director of football. I'm responsible for this. That director of football reports to me. You report to me as well. That's how this works. But he's been weak the whole way along. He's been completely bamboozled by the fact. Remember the video of them signing Schweinsteiger? Oh, you see the name Schweinsteiger on the team sheet. You're like, wow. Like, he had not watched enough football or doesn't know enough about football to be able to go, well, that was a stupid signing. All of those signings that they, the Alexis Sanchez signing and the money they gave him, that's on him.
And it is at that point that he should have realised, I probably need a director of football here. I need somebody that's not Ed Woodward actually signing off on these sort of things. So I don't know why he's done it. If he hasn't done it by now, I don't actually see when he would do it.
What about summer transfers? Is that one of our stories as well?
Yeah, well, we're looking at Ziyech here because he's the big story. Obviously, the Ajax winger on his way to Chelsea, it seems, this summer. Like, it will be Lampard's first big signing, and something that I would say would add a good bit to their attack. You're making a grimace beside me, Kenny Cunningham.
But I think it's an interesting one, because obviously publicly he came out after the transfer window shut. Lampard was the first signs of it. He wasn't happy the fact that players hadn't come in that transfer window. He certainly wanted a forward. I think he wants a left back as well. I thought it was more of a second striker to play alongside Abraham, to be honest with you, but he didn't get it. He's gone and got Ziyech, who actually operates more or less off the sides, but he wouldn't be in terms of that top bracket. A lot of talk about Sancho going there in the summer. Now, Ziyech, I'd say he's a very good player, very talented footballer. You've seen him play as well, but probably in terms of his numbers probably wouldn't be up there with the likes of Sancho and other players. So it might be a small indication, maybe, in terms of where Lampard is actually shopping in relation to the other clubs ahead of him.
Well, if he's going for Ziyech, does it mean that perhaps they're waiting or expecting that Sancho won't actually come to the club?
Well, I think that's a fair indication. I think it's an indication that he knows Pedro's out the door in the summer.
Yeah.
Potentially William might be gone as well.
Batshuayi will be gone.
Batshuayi, I think it's that second striker one, to be honest with you. He would have let Giroud go out the door.
He'll be gone in the summer as well.
Yeah, Giroud's going to be gone this summer, so he needs a second striker. But that's not an easy thing.
That's a revolution, really. Like, quietly, those players whose contracts are coming to an end. That's going to be a completely different Chelsea squad next year.
Totally, because, like, obviously you had Hazard leaving last year as well.
Yeah, no, it is. No, he's got work to do. He's still got the spine of a decent side there, but he needs some key acquisitions. They're absolutely right. I'm not exactly sure he needs them in the wide areas. He needs that second striker who'll actually work in tandem with Tammy Abrahams, and that's not easy. Can't go and spend huge money on a striker. A lot of talk of Cavani coming in. Got to go, oh yeah, great signing, Cavani. Oh, mate, he's got to go and get him. But I never saw the Cavani one. For me, that was a potential problem he was bringing into the dressing room. You can't bring Edward Cavani into the club, give him a 3-year contract, absolute fortune, and then expect him to sit on the bench for every second game, knowing that Abraham needs those type of games to continue his development.
So this is we're talking about somebody to play alongside Pulisic behind Tammy Abraham, is that?
And we're talking about a second striker. Ideally, what you need now, people talk about, he needs a centre forward. Ideally, he needs someone who can play as a centre forward, but ideally can actually flip and play in one of the wide areas as well. It's kind of the modern forward, the kind of wide midfielder, winger, centre forward. Now they've almost morphed into one. Liverpool's the greatest example. Mane, Salah. And even for me, now, Finn more so in the middle. But Salah, we've come inside and seen him play down the middle. Mane could come inside. They can play off either flanks. The ideal now is to bring in forwards in the modern game, particularly the top clubs, who can really operate anywhere across the front line. So they can play as that central striker. Abraham comes out with a team. Yes, they can go and play 20 games as centre forward. But when Abraham comes back, it's not a case of, well, only one of these can play as your number nine in a kind of like regimented system. Mm. Well, one of them can flip easily over onto the flanks and get his quota of games there as well. So ideally, this is the type of modern type forward all the top clubs are looking for. Not one who can only operate in one single area of the pitch.
Yeah. All right. We'll talk a bit more about transfers. Obviously, there's plenty of time for us to do that. Exactly 8:30 this morning here on OTBM. Last night, Dublin defender Johnny Cooper joined Joe on Off the Ball. The full interview worth checking out on our YouTube channel or in our GAA podcast stream on the OTB podcast network. Here's Johnny talking about playing on the edge.
I love the cutting edge. I love the cliff edge where sometimes I have fallen off and took the wrong step for whatever reason. And then sometimes I've remained there. I've showed mental resolve. I've done enough research. I have the capabilities in that moment to make the decision. I just love the way there's no safety net. Mm. Okay, there's a goalkeeper behind you or not too far away from you. But ultimately, which again, it comes back to when my first game, I think it was my first game against Kildare a number of years ago, I slipped and a goal goes in and that is it. Mm. And that is what I love about it. And then, you know, and I've had many good and bad examples of that. I love it. I love the research. I love sometimes I'm too detailed and too obsessive, but you know, I just love the whole area. And again, I think it applies well beyond sports, you know, applies to relationships. I said I'm very ambitious professionally as well. So I'm trying to apply that kind of some of those elements to that.
You're very welcome along to this week's Shot Clock. It is Ger Gilroy against Kieran Donaghy. Every week here, Kieran Donaghy racing into an early lead in the first couple of editions of the 2020 Shot Clock. Last week, we kind of revamped
note,
the scoring.
That's important to note.
Very important to note. We've got predictions. We've got a free throw coming up where Kieran will go on a rant about something. And then starting things off, we've got the Shot Clock where we get into three debating topics. If you make a good argument, you're going to hear a sound that sounds something like this. And if you make a bad argument, which was like basically Jerry's Gooch argument last week, you're going to hear something like this. So you try and keep score throughout. Try and pick a winner. The first topic this week is stats versus skills. Kian Mackey this week talking about the idea that perhaps there's a lot of work done on GPS stats when it comes to inter-county football. Are we getting carried away with this? Is there too much focus on how many sprints you've done, how many hand passes you make, how many successful kick passes you make? And is there not enough work being done with the naked eye in GEA coaching? Kieran, what do you think?
I think there's certain merit to what Keane has said, and I think Keane, having just retired like maybe myself a year ago, I think stats become a bugbearer of older players when they maybe mightn't be hitting some certain numbers, but I do believe that he is right in what he says. I think there's the level of GPS detail going in now is huge. It goes up in the dressing room after every game. Guys come in afterwards, they want to see what high-speed distance they covered, what distance in general they covered. There's new types of metrics coming on all the time. Stats then are a part of that as well. How many turnovers did you have? How many hand passes did you have? How many foot passes did you have? And look, we can all go out and have a perfect 100% pass rating if we take no risks and we tip hand passes around and play really safe passes all day long. But that's not going to unlock defences. That's not going to help you win a game. And I think there's new stats should be looked at. Maybe something like good decisions. How many good decisions did you make in a game? I think is a much more important stat than a lot of that other stuff that we just talked about. Did you play a long early ball into one-on-one? Yes, it was a turnover, but was it a good decision? Absolutely, it was a good decision. Did you execute the skill? No. What do we need to do? We need to work on that skill. Did you make the extra pass at a time where your team needed the extra pass to create a good score? Absolutely. That was a good decision for the team. What would have been a bad decision? You shooting. Did you go and double team on defence? Did you help at the right time? Did you leave your men at the right time and spot where the danger was? Look at the Dublin goals last year in the All-Ireland final. Players streaming through the middle.
But they're not statistics.
But they're the good decisions. Can you have a stat that's good decisions on your name?
Probably not.
That's your naked eye. That's you're talking about.
What's going on here? Are you stealing my lines? What? Shut up. You sit there. You referee.
Yeah.
Well, go give your argument then.
Old Gil Donaghy here couldn't hack it with the kids at training last year, and so he's decided that the technology is the issue. The technology is not the issue. Just before we get started on this, I don't know if everybody understands that most of the GPS systems that you see around the world are actually from an Irish company. They're based in Uri, bunch of lads from Dundalk who set this whole thing up. We should be proud of the fact that we're world leaders in this, but we just don't know how to use it yet because the technology is too new. What you do need is somebody, as Kieran says, who is sitting there going, was that sprint actually an intelligent sprint? Famously, the offensive linemen in the NFL found out about the fact that they were being monitored and they would walk around in circles, ultimately leaving little trails as their fat heaps of bones were wearing out
that,
the grass.
I did a bit of that near the end.
Exactly, and that's what happens. Because the managers don't actually know the science behind what they're trying to achieve. Essentially, this should be used in collaboration with players for making the players make better decisions. You're not supposed to be sprinting wildly 40 times a game. You're supposed to be in your top speed two or three times when you're burning defenders. That means you're actually wasting your energy. Imagine if we'd had somebody teaching Robbie Keane that all that running that he did was a complete waste of his time. He could have been Leo Messi. If you watch Leo Messi frequently just stands there. He has stood stationary while all around him is a maelstrom, and he's working out where the space is. He's doing the calculations in his brain, not wasting energy. This is about conserving energy. And actually, if GPS was being used properly, you would be able to use older players like Kieran and Cian Mackey properly, beneficially, saying, you've got a 15-minute period here where you're going to absolutely go hell for leather, and we're going to lorry ball in on you, or we're going to play ball to the right corner forward. Use your sprints properly. We need to learn how to use stats, not be afraid of them.
Yeah, I think, and I think that's actually an issue. I think players are doing a lot of running these days because maybe they feel like they have to, because if they don't hit certain numbers, then it's perceived that they're not working. Of course, there's a lot of numbers, much more numbers now on the defensive side of the game, the tracking, the chasing cornerbacks, which is something that didn't have to be done. But the truest point you said was on Messi, and the great GAA footballers often stand and wait and make one move and get a ball.
Armad took Kieran Donaghy off famously in the game against Tyrone because he hadn't touched the ball. Not Kieran Donaghy, Kieran McGeaney off in the game against Tyrone, famously in All-Ireland semi-final. And it was the most stupid decision of all time based on a misunderstanding of statistics.
Did he have a GPS on him?
No.
It was to do with, like, he hadn't touched the ball. I thought, would they not have had them in? Probably not.
I don't think they'd stats.
Second topic today, I think it's pretty even. I'm not sure. I think Jeremiah.
What are you talking about? I'm miles ahead.
1 point lead.
Unassailable lead.
Baseline standards is what we are talking about. This comes off the back of the discussion on Virgin Media Sport on Saturday when Matt Williams was making the point that this should be the minimum for Ireland, beating Wales at home. Well, not so much that. The performance that Ireland put in and the attitude that they showed, that should be the minimum for Ireland. Ronan O'Gara disagreed with him. He said that is absolutely not the minimum. Getting a bonus point win at home against Wales is not the minimum. Is Matt Williams right, though? Is there a sense that actually, within the camp, Ireland players are saying to themselves, yeah, this is what we should be doing week in, week out, especially in this year's Six Nations? Jerry, you can lead this one off.
100% correct, Matt Williams here. If you think back to what Roy Keane was saying all those years ago about Ireland and the tyranny of low expectations, we still have it with Mick McCarthy. We still have it. We've had it in Irish football history where constantly managers talk down our ability and our expectations. We should expect ourselves to be better. We should expect ourselves to play well. I can't wait for Stephen Kenny to come in and say, we're going to get the ball and we're going to keep it. I don't think the Kerry footballers once ever went into a game and expected they were going to scrape through. They always thought that they were going to play well and they were going to demand standards off each other. I think Ronan O'Gara might have missed a point when he was saying the bonus point win. He's talking about the results, but no doubt if Ronan O'Gara was in that changing room, immediately afterwards he'd be in that dressing room going, that's exactly how we're supposed to play. We're Ireland. We dominate forwards. We play creatively in the backs. We have offloads. We swarm the ball. We get in the referee's face and we absolutely manage the game. I think as a player, he would have said exactly what Matt Williams was saying. I think there was a good bit of punditry for Matt Williams to go, Ireland needs to reconsider itself when it comes to sport, going, what is the basic minimum standard that we have? Is it a wishy-washy, sure, look, we'll do our best and we'll go out? This is elite sport we're talking about. This is not participation.
I know, but that's what we always say, though, Gerard. Like everywhere, every business you go into, Irish people play themselves down. That's our defence mechanism. That's our coping mechanism within the business, within the team structure. Of course we want to be perfect. Of course we want to have minimum standards. But I do agree with O'Gara on one thing. I think he said that the game the last day was, you know, a bonus point against Wales, who are a really good team, real high standard team. We played really well to get that win. Fellas played. There was moments of magic by players that helped get us over the line. There was also instances where Wales should have had a try and made mistakes that would have made the game a lot closer. And then if the game is a lot closer and we end up losing, is that our minimum standards? Every game has to be taken on its own merits. Every time you play against somebody, it has to be taken on its own merits. You can't just say this is a baseline minimum standard, because that minimum standard changes all the time. And he was saying, effort, getting up and down, tackling, that's the minimum standards.
Yes.
But what we did the last day, Ireland, was different to what we've been doing all along. There was a clear change of tact from the management. We offloaded more on the tackle. We got it out wide inside our own 22. We were taking on guys. That's different to what Ireland have been doing. We've been put it under the jumper, fall down on the ground, try and get outside the 22, throw it back and kick it dead. That was being the way we played. So there was a clear change of tactics as well the last day, which has to be taken into consideration.
Which backs up Williams' points.
100%. Bayern Munich don't expect to win the Champions League every year. They expect to win the league. Their basic minimum standard is we're going to win the league. They understand that in the vagaries of a cup competition, knockout football, you might not win every time that you play in the Champions League. What their basic minimum standards are, that there's going to be a series of performances that are better than the previous one, that's layered on top. I think that if Ireland had lost that game but played well, our basic minimum standard was that we were doing all the things we said we would do. And the result then is a window that is dependent on how well the other team plays and factors outside your control.
You're also sitting there going, why are they throwing it outside? Why are they keeping it inside the 22? What are they doing? But when you get a win, it masks everything. When you get a lose, it highlights all the negatives. So it's a dicey game to play. But having minimum standards, it should be within every team, but they're always kept internal. You're never going to come out and say it. So it was a good piece of analysis.
Exactly, yeah.
Tommy Rooney is keeping score this week, and by all accounts, Ger might be running away with it this week. Just a little preview, but we do have one more.
I need
topic
the Kerry judge
way.
Back on board. Can we get Tommy Rooney struck off?
It's only by one, actually,
I can confirm. Moving on to the final topic, it's Tyrone. Colin McShane back in a Tyrone jersey last weekend. Conor McKenna potentially coming back for Tyrone in a couple of weeks. We saw Darren McCurry running rings around the Kerry defence last weekend up in Eden Dork. Are Tyrone the best contender to Kerry Dublin? Can they actually break the top two, Kieran?
I think they're extremely dangerous, and I think they can if they get everything right, especially if they can land Conor McKenna back. I don't know what the story, I don't know, is it family reasons? I don't really want to speak about why he's back, but you know, maybe Tyrone played an absolute masterstroke and said, you know what we'll do? We'll send Kyle McShane out. Kyle McShane will go out, infest into the brain of Conor McKenna and bring him back. And now Tyrone will really have a chance. Tyrone played in the All-Ireland final in 2018. And in 2019, they were right there with Kerry. They had Kerry pushed to the pin of their collar. It was 9-5 at halftime. I remember being sitting inside in the Sky studio going, this is deja vu. It's happening all over again. A Kerry team with more stars is being held and being beaten badly by a Tyrone team that are more cohesive, that are frustrating Kerry, that are getting back, they're getting in their ears. They have Paddy Hamsey to come back, they have Matty Donnelly to come back. If they could land McKenna, and he is a game changer with his pace, he's a Jack McCaffrey, he opens teams up. Tyrone can go win an All-Ireland with that team, and I think that's...
McKenna hasn't kicked a round ball in 7 or 8 years at this stage. Like, he was a minor when he left. This isn't the case of somebody who has been an all-star, who we've seen dominate games. It's also, like, he's a young guy. You're joking me.
Shut up. Is he gone taken off there? McKenna hasn't kicked the ball. He hasn't. I agree with you, Ger. He hasn't kicked the wrong ball. He's probably tipped around with it. I'm sure he's tipped around with it out in Australia. But they're not banned from having it. But what I would say is Conor McKenna's pace and power and his physique at the moment, he doesn't have to kick a ball at all in a game. If he plays 1-2s and drives through the defences, he will be hand-passing it across the square for Darren McCurry to hand-pass into the net. That's what he can do. That's his power. That's his pace. That's how dangerous he'll be for Tyrone.
This notion that somehow Mickey Hart has been playing chess while all the rest of the counties have been playing checkers is nonsensical. Because if Tyrone were this good, where the hell were they last year? They flocked to the second half.
They were in All-Ireland semi-final with the game in the balance. They were leading.
They choked like they did in the All-Ireland final.
They made one mistake. Tyrone should have had a point. They made a turnover. Paul Gainey comes up the pitch. Goal for Kerry. Momentum changes. We know big momentum is in sport. We talked about it last year in shot clock.
Here we go.
The big mo is the most important thing in sport.
Exactly.
Kerry got it with about 10 minutes to go. Tommy Walsh came on and changed the game. The Kerry goal. Other than that, Tyrone would have been playing Dublin again last year in the All-Ireland final. So who's to say that they're not the guys to break
because
the Kerry-Dublin dominance at the moment?
Kerry are a much better team this year than they were last year on the simple basis of the fact that they're going to have a full season of Tommy Walsh. They know how to use him. They've got the advanced mark to do it. And they also have the most singular talent that we've seen in Gaelic football history in David Clifford, who is rising, who is cresting to an absolute superstar status. And O'Shea is going to be much better at centre forward as well because he's just more experienced.
Can I just say Kenny Cunningham took over the scoreboard duties there for just a moment, and Kieran got 1 point for a conspiracy theory and Jura got docked 1 point for describing the actual shape of a ball. So if you believe in tangible arguments, the shot clock is not the place for you. Do we have a winner in this week's shot clock debates? We might get to that in just a moment. Kenny Cunningham is in the studio. Kieran Donaghy all day, says Kenny Cunningham in the box. Thank you very much to our guest scoreboard presenter, Kenny Cunningham. He'll be back with us very shortly. Before that, though, it is time for the free throw. Because last Friday afternoon, Kieran Donaghy was wandering about, I don't know where he was, maybe home, maybe at work. And all of a sudden, he felt the warm sensation of a dagger through his back. Because here in studio, Ger Gilroy was talking to Tony McEntee. What point did he put to him, Ger?
Well, so last week we were talking about football, and I was asking the question off the back of the NFL season, are there different types of defence that a GAA team can use, a Gaelic football team in particular? Can you have different types of it? Can you go man? Can you go zonal? Can you go zonal in parts? Can you go man-to-man for different sections? Can you pick a team based on who your opposition are? Which is all the type of things that you would expect from an American football team. And Kieran said, yeah, this is absolutely the situation that we need to be getting to. You're beginning to see parts of it. It's there in basketball and how confusing it can be for a couple of minutes in basketball if, for example, team switches and you're like, hang on a second, we need to do this. Like, why couldn't we do this in Gaelic football? Put that to Tony McEntee. Here's what happened.
So I think, Jeff, first of all, I'm not sure if Kieran could be more wrong in his angle. And I think it's maybe because of his Kerry, and maybe not just his Kerry, but the Kerry approach to defending. Or maybe, in some views, the lack of Kerry approach to defending in that they try to apply an attacking, attractive brand of football. The reality is, at the minute, is that defending is such an art at the minute. And everybody is trying to explore a different angle or a different view to it.
Kieran Donaghy, you couldn't be more wrong.
I think, you know, look, I disagree with Tony. I think there is definitely maybe two styles of defence to play. I think he's underestimating the power of the athletes from 6 inches up here. I think to suggest that we only know one way of defending or one team can only do one way of defending in a season or a game, I think it's a bit of an injustice to players. I think players are very intelligent now. I think players do more research. We heard about Johnny Cooper, the amount of research he puts into the game yesterday. A big thing, 2014, we got ridiculed for being, as Tony suggested, that we might know much about defence in Kerry. We made the slight defensive adjustment and we got slated for being boring and negative by keeping our two half-backs back to protect against a very good inside Donegal full forward line with McFadden, Murphy and McBrearty. We got slated for that. If you look at what we did that day, we tweaked our game plan on a given day. 3 weeks before, we said, OK, we're going to stop attacking with our half-backs. We're going to stop driving people up the field. And we're just going to hold, because we saw what Donegal had done previous years. We saw what they did to Dublin 2 or 3 years before that, is they suck you up the field and they hit you with a deadly counter-attack with the forwards that they have. So, like, for teams, if you're losing a game, and in that same game, Donegal were losing. They were down 3 or 4 points with 6 or 7 minutes to go, and Kerry were passing the ball. We were passing the ball around the middle of the field and they were back in their defensive zone, which had been drilled into them. That's the way we play. Get back, get numbers. And they stayed in that zone and they moved across and they moved across. Eventually, somebody obviously said, OK, guys, we have to start pushing out. We're down 4 or 5 points. We have to start pushing up. And what happened is Donegal came out of their set without any coaching, without any backroom staff, without any ideas about how to do it. They just went ball chasing and they turned a 4-point deficit into a 1-point deficit at a time where we were really under pressure. And if you remember, we got it back. They got it back to a point. We went back up 2 and they had that famous chance when McFadden fisted the ball off the butt of the post in the last minute, which would have drawn the game because they pushed out after us. So what I'm saying is, of course you can, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think you can coach a team to have a set defensive play, a set defensive style and structure about you that Tony says is right. Every team is exploring. So if every team is exploring, there's obviously different options out there. Why can't you have 1 or 2 of those up your sleeve? Why can't you, with 10 minutes to go in the first half and you need momentum, try and put on a press on a team? I'm not saying a basketball press. I'm not saying you leave fellas open all over the place. But how do you go after the ball? What did we see Dublin do last week against Monaghan? They were losing the game. They were under all sorts of pressure. And they pushed up and they put on this kind of press. They went after the ball. Fellas left men outside them. Fellas moved the line up the pitch. And they got turnovers and they found their way back into a game. So I disagree with Tony McEntee in the fact that you can't have 1 or 2 or possibly even 3 defensive structures winning, especially in the inter-county game. You're talking about, we talked about, Gerard talked about time that you have with your team now at inter-county level. How can't you have maybe 2 different looks that you throw at teams defensively? And how can't you have a call that you switch from one to the other? Yes, it would be challenging. Yes, there's ways to tweak it. Yes, you may get found out. But you have to have some way that you're playing when you're winning a game. And you have to have some way to play when you're losing a game. We talk about a lot on the offensive side of the ball. Oh, if we're losing a game with 5 minutes to go, how are we going to get back into it? The same goes for defence. And I think teams can. And I think players should be challenged to have a way of thinking that you can be given a call and that you defend a different way for a certain amount of time.
I think that's a fair point. So say, for example, a team is chasing a 6-point deficit with 3 or 4 minutes to go and the 7 or 8 minutes that are coming in injury time. Your defence needs to know how to defend those big balls that are coming in. There's just going to be a lot of balls lashed in around the house. I presume teams train for that. I'm not sure if they do, but if they don't, they should do. And that's just an example of this, except in a smaller very situational example. There are obviously other examples where, you know, you take a big lead and all of a sudden you start to play a bit soft, but that's exactly the time when you should be more aggressive to try and kill teams off.
Yeah, I think there's momentum. Like, we see, you know, you see the press working from kickouts, and you see Dublin put it on very, very strongly last year at times in games, and it's intimidating because, you know, they're gaining momentum by winning ball after ball after ball. That's the thing with the basketball, with when you do press in basketball, it's to get momentum, it's to get yourself back into game. And I think sometimes that we should look more into that in the GAA. Is it hard to coach? Absolutely. Would it be a challenge to coach? Absolutely. But it doesn't mean you don't try. That doesn't mean you don't challenge players. We challenge players in the gym. We challenge them with their diet, the amount of kicking they do, the amount of running we do. Do we challenge guys enough up here? I think Dublin are ahead of the curve with how much they challenge their players up here to think on the spot and in games.
On to predictions. NBA All-Star weekend. Kieran, you're not overly enthused by this. Team LeBron against Team Giannis.
I predict lots of points. I win.
I think LeBron's team is going to win the All-Star game. I think their starting five is arguably the best starting five up there, with the best starting fives ever to start an All-Star game. You've got LeBron, you've got Anthony Davis at centre, you've LeBron at power forward, you've Luka Doncic, the teenage sensation, playing at the three spot. You've Kawhi Leonard, the best defender and probably the best two-way player in the league. And you've got James Harden. And if James Harden actually played like a proper point guard and passed the ball, which he doesn't do for Houston, but he might do in an All-Star game, that five is scary. Every one of them can beat you any type of way. So I'm going to go with Team LeBron.
Does this concept work? One of my abiding memories as a kid is queuing in Thurles for Jack O'Shea's autograph as a child. It was after Matt Connor had his accident. The All-Stars played a Rest of Ireland team and it was sensational. They played hurling and football on the same day, so it was a huge crowd. We went down to it and you were out on the pitch afterwards to collect autographs. And like those two teams, as far as I remember, I was seven, like absolutely went at it. Certainly that was my sense of it. It was like it was a competitive game. Both sides were trying to put on a good show. And it never evolved into anything else after that. Like, kind of what an interprovincial game could be. It should be an all-star weekend where, you know, everybody gets money.
And doesn't play any defence.
It doesn't play any defence. Well, maybe you do play a blanket defence and you try and win it. Ulster win 1-0. And that would be like the perfect. But like, is there not some way of making these competitive to the point where it's worthwhile?
Yeah, I think so. Might be a topic we might get into more next week. But yeah. I think absolutely teams should go cut at it. But yeah, I think, who have you got?
Can we steal? I don't know.
I think you both got Team LeBron.
Are you going with Team LeBron as well? Okay.
There's hurling this weekend. Galway against Tip, I think it's probably the standout fixture. Ger, who are you calling in this one?
Tip.
I'll go with Galway. I think Galway need a win and they need a bit of momentum after a poor showing in Limerick 2 weeks ago. So I think Galway will get it done at home, and I think Joe Canning's back, which would be a big help.
And you're going to the Bridge on Monday night, Chelsea against Manchester United?
Yeah, Chelsea. I'll go with a Chelsea home win.
I'm going to go with a draw.
Okay, very good. Enjoy Stamford Bridge, Kieran. That's it for the Shot Clock this week. We'll have more from Kieran and Kenny Cunningham very shortly. Tom Malone will be with us in studio soon too. Before that, here's Ronan O'Gara on the Six Nations.
I think the ambition has been for the Wales game was better, and their accuracy of passing was a little bit better. Fine margins, like, kind of, you know, maybe overestimated it live, but like Hadley Parks gets that down, it's still 30 minutes to go, 5-point game, Joe. It's a different game again. And I think what is very clear from the first two weekends is this championship is up for grabs. You couldn't say any team is standing out over another team from my point of view. France 2 out of 2, but would have probably a little bit of hindsight struggled against Italy. Going to Wales next, extremely difficult game. England at home. Ireland have to go to Stade de France. So, you know, I mean, Ireland are left with two very difficult away games, one easy home game. Wales at home are different. They're going to be hurting a bit. They have to respond. So it's a hard one to call, potentially between, obviously, Ireland, England, Wales and France.
Right, Tom Malone is here. Time for the sports news.
Yeah, we'll start with the Gaelic Games, and the Gaelic Players Association have called the Intercounty Games a revenue-generating machine as they reacted strongly to the GAA's annual report. GAA Director General has Tom Ryan has said the near €30 million spent on preparing and fielding intercounty teams was unsustainable. But CEO of the Players Association, Paul Flynn, has responded to such claims, painting intercounty players as the GAA's problem child. Meanwhile, on the pitch last night, 14-man UCC came from behind to retain Hurling's Electric Ireland Fitzgibbon Cup, trailing IT Carlow by 4 points at half-time. UCC also had Niall O'Leary sent off in the second half. Despite that, the Cork side ran out 18 points to 2-11 winners at the DCU Sports Ground, and UCC boss Tom Kingston says it's a hugely important victory.
Every student in college that plays hurling, the Fitzgibbon Cup means everything. And for if anybody don't rate the Fitzgibbon Cup, then they should look at these games, and it shows what it means to the players. They pour their heart and their soul out on those pitches to win these games. And it's incredible. It's a magnificent competition.
Meanwhile, the shape of the League of Ireland took fully clear last night, with Shamrock Rovers 2 granted a licence after Limerick were backed out of the process. Rather, the Rovers reserve side take the place of Limerick, who were initially denied a licence due to financial issues in December. And despite Lake taking legal action that would allow them to apply, Limerick are ultimately not among the 20 applicants who were granted licences in the League of Ireland. Also, Brian Murphy has returned to the League of Ireland after a decade away. The 36-year-old keeper has joined his hometown club, Waterford. Murphy left for Ipswich back in 2010 and went on to have spells at QPR, Portsmouth and Cardiff. Meanwhile, West Brom moved 6 points clear at the top of the Championship last night with a 2-1 away win at Reading. It was a third win in a row for the Albion. And boss Slaven Bilic says his side are gaining some momentum in their push for promotion.
In the last three games we got it, and we deserve it. And now we are still, unfortunately, a long, long way to go. Mm-hmm. But we are ready for that.
Elsewhere, Fulham missed out on the chance to climb the table. They could have gone second, but they only got a 1-1 draw away to Millwall. Republic of Ireland midfielder Alan Brown scored for Preston, who stayed in the playoff spots with a 2-0 win at Stoke. Ireland striker James Collins scored the only goal as struggling Luton beat Sheffield Wednesday 1-0, while Celtic hammered Hearts by 5-0 to open up a 10-point lead at the top of the Scottish Premiership as Rangers lost 2-1 at Kilmarnock.
Daryl Shea played in that whole game for West Brom last night. We know Slaven Bilic loves him, and just getting into the team properly now, getting a bit of a run.
Yeah, it's a fantastic opportunity for him now. Like, obviously, we're fairly well stocked with centre-backs at the moment, but he looks like he's the best poised to come through and become the next star at centre-half. Like, as you mentioned, Bilic seems to be a huge fan of this guy, and he obviously...
According to live score, he played right back last night as well. So,
oh, right, okay.
A bit of flexibility there.
Yeah, like, because obviously he made a bit of a breakthrough at the start of the season. Bilic spoke him up a good bit, and then it was kind of until the FA Cup third round, really, at the start of last month that he was kind of back in the team. I think he scored a goal in the FA Cup third round. So, like, he's impressive. Like, is there kind of a Shane Duffy element to him that he poses a threat at both sides of the pitch? But the fact that he also plays right back, I didn't realise that. So,
that's another impressive. Right back.
No.
Could he be the perfect right of a three?
Right of a three. And
scored
then
his first league goal at the weekend as well.
So there you go. It's been a good season for him so far, and definitely one that's going to be on the radar sooner rather than later. In a squad sooner rather than later.
Yeah, and by the looks of things, in the Premier League next year as well, the way West Brom are going. We'll finish up with golf. Rory McIlroy tees off as world number one for the first time in nearly 5 years. Today, he'll be in company of Patrick Cantlay and Dustin Johnson in the opening round of the Genesis Open on the PGA Tour in LA later. And the County Down golfer is not in the mood to relinquish that ranking anytime
Everyone
soon.
Keeps saying congratulations. I saw that the work's only started. It's staying there is the hard part. But I have always said it's a byproduct of doing the right things week in, week out, playing well, shooting good scores, trying to win tournaments.
Yeah, more golf in a moment with John Duggan. Tom, thanks very much for that. More from Ronan O'Gara here. So let's hear him talk about Robbie Henshaw.
I've been kind of watching for a long number of years. I still think there's another 40% to come. I genuinely do. He just, every time he gets a run, he's cut down with a... It's not a mysterious injury or illness, but he's had bad luck with kind of either lower back into chronic hamstring, into breaks, into
dislocated shoulder and things like that. Yeah,
yeah, that's a big one. But yeah, there was huge promise from him at the weekend. But I was in Irish camp for a number of years with him, and he was really he was a really impressive passer.
Right.
So I think. You know, he's lucky, you know, in the fact that he's had all Joe's brilliant guidance, I think. Then he's had a different spark from Lancaster. Now he's getting a different spark from Farrell. So, you know, talking to Mike Catt for him will be really interesting, because he's just getting another, I suppose, layer of learning that he can filter into games.
OTB AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Show her that you know her.
Yeah, 9 o'clock this morning here on OTBAM. And of course, it's Valentine's week. We all know that. And this week, we've partnered up with Pandora to solve your needs. You can find the perfect gift this Valentine's Day with Pandora. We're here to give you a guide to some of the great options. You can check out pandora.net for all the details. But for your complete gift guide, myself and Adrian Barry, resident OTB romance correspondents, went down to Pandora and Grafton Street this week to find out what it's all about.
We know, and you know, we all need a little bit of help from time to time. That's why this week, OTBAM have teamed up with Pandora to bring you some gift advice for the most special week of all. It's the week of love, Adrian. It's Valentine's week.
Love is in the air, Ger. I'm useless at this stuff, I have to say. I'm absolutely useless.
It's stormy outside. It's going to be stormy inside if we don't get these decisions right.
Emma's going to talk us through it. Let's go.
Let's get some help. Thanks for having us again.
No problem.
Two handsome young gentlemen were here, according to our video yesterday. Anyway, you were showing us bracelets. I went home and floated the idea of a bracelet. Wants a necklace.
She wants a necklace.
What have you got for us?
Perfect. So if she wants a necklace, that's a good option as well. So at the moment for Valentine's, we actually have a special edition one here. So it is our free-handed heart and our earring set for €99. So you get a good discount on this one. Or if you wanted to customise something, again, what does she love? And so her own little style, you can actually build a necklace yourself. So this one here is our necklace chain, our Pandora carrier, and then a Pandora charm on top of that. So you can literally customize the necklace to suit her kind of style as well.
Explain the charm thing, will you? How does that work?
So the charms in this one here, so it's very much what I have on. So you've got your necklace, your carrier, and then you just pop your charms onto it, like what I showed you yesterday with the bracelets. In this case, you're just going to wear it as a necklace instead. And again, it comes in three different styles. It comes in shine, Pandora silver, and then Pandora rose as well. So you've got three metals, so you can really mix it up yourself.
Cool. And if you want to go for something entirely different, then you've got one other option for us.
You've got one other option, because at the moment you actually have got a promotion on. If you spend €109, you get a free set of our Tree of Life earrings here. So they're great then if you want to think ahead. These are well ahead for Mother's Day as well. You've got your Mother's Day gift here as well.
Well, it's 2 days out from Valentine's, so I don't know where all that planned.
You never know. I had a guy in this morning who was getting everything.
Right.
Very organized.
Take a good run at the year.
Yeah,
wow,
was he actually just getting Valentine's Day stuff for his ma and was too ashamed to say, look, you know, I'm keeping everybody happy.
Probably, yeah.
Playing
yeah.
to the crowd.
That's good thinking. I like his style.
So, yeah, there are three options there if you wanted something away from the classic bracelet, but you still have the Pandora charms on it.
Brilliant.
So, again, over time, you can add to these.
Thanks, Anna. Great stuff.
Right, so hopefully that idiot's guide was useful for you. And if you want to show her that you know her, just head over to Pandora.net to check out the hashtag PandoraValentines for more information. You can also get more info on offtheball.com. And if there was nothing in today's installment that floated your gondola, tune in again tomorrow when Emma will have more Pandora goodness to bring your way. Remember, Pandora suits all budgets. And if you spend €109, you can get free earrings, leaving you sorted for gifts for your mum and sister. Now, all this week, we're also giving you the chance to win a €100 voucher for Pandora every morning on OTBAM until Valentine's Day. It's all with thanks to Pandora. To enter, just share this morning's OTBAM wherever you're watching and use the hashtag PandoraValentines. Best of luck. Have you been around yet, Owen? Have you got sorted for your needs this week?
No, I must take a trip in to...
Well, your time is passing and running and running and passing.
Jewelry. How does it feel to be a jewellery expert?
It's got like 24 hours. I mean, here's the thing, you never become an expert. You just layer on information. It's like the little charms. You just layer them on as time goes on. Oh,
that is the smoothest segue I've ever heard. You're getting good at this.
9:05 here this morning. John Duggan and Kenny Cunningham. I mean, two men who know a lot about love are up next.
OTB AM. This
is OTB Sports Radio. The Sunday pay-per-view on Off The Ball.
When he wants to do something, he does it. A hugely impressive person, apart from being obviously a brilliant golfer.
My cousins disliked their dog so intensely that they renamed it Scalacci.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the dog was called Scalacci from then on.
It's a great piece of journalism. That sums up what he's like. The intro to this is just brilliant. He is an absolute control freak.
Digesting the best stories on the back pages every Sunday afternoon on Off The Ball. OTB AM.
Brought to you by Pandora. Celebrate love with a special gift.
I'd like to think, I know I had no idea who I was. That would be right too. But then when Annie was talking about Flanagan, he was talking about his younger brother enjoying it. So I guess just on a very basic level, you're able to connect with him. And you're, like, obviously, I'm looking to learn myself, but you don't want it all to be a one-way relationship. You're trying to think, oh, God, I know Clonagale, I know the area. It's a great club, lots of structure. And he's trying to connect that to his own brother, who's obviously enjoying it. So you're trying to, I guess, be respectful and not have it all be a one-way relationship. But at the same time, you know, I have a couple more years left in my own sports career potentially, and you're trying to then maximise and extract everything you can. And obviously talking to one of the best people in his craft in the world, and getting that opportunity, it's hard to kind of fathom as well how you actually get it. But when you're sitting there across and 2 foot away from him and you're seeing what you see through a TV set most of the time, it's kind of a bit surreal in many ways, but also you're in the moment, so you're trying to, as I said, be in the moment, but also be very responsive. And how did you see that, or what would you do there, and how could I then map that back onto my world, professionally and sportingly, and obviously personally as well.
Yeah, so Johnny Cooper there talking about Owen Farrell and the opportunity he had to talk with him. In the meantime, Kenny's come up with a doppelganger for me, saying Alex Stewart, the cricketer.
Yeah, slimline Alex Stewart.
A little bit, yeah, a little bit.
Thanks, John.
Yeah. Not sure if we're having
that.
Wicketkeeper and Surrey batsman.
That is.
Thank you.
That's as bad as doppelganger shout as I've ever seen. It's nothing like him.
He does, slim down version, athletic version. He does. There's a bit of it. Cheers, John.
We let the Twitter mafia decide in the aftermath. Right, it's time for, John's here, it's time for Virtual Insanity. How are you, John?
We're going to actually, before we get into Virtual Insanity, a little bit of tension building because we like to do it here. We're going to chat about Premier League golf before we get into your tips, John.
Tommy's shouting at me there, sorry. This is what we're supposed to do.
Is it GPA-GAA style tension or a little
100%
bit
100% GPA-GAA style tension. We were talking about this yesterday morning, John, Premier League golf. Tiger Woods has been commenting about it this week, not totally ruling out his potential participation in this new idea that might be floated. So is it something that you think could potentially live and succeed in modern golf? Because
it could see
the rich get richer.
It could succeed if Tiger is into it, and if Rory's into it, they'll have to be part of it. But Tiger's 44 years of age now, and the Tiger Woods has made golfers rich, and he's made a lot of sports stars rich.
TV networks rich. He's made sponsors rich.
Yeah. He didn't only just change golf with that 1997 Masters win. He changed sport, and he changed the money side of sport, the commercial side of sport. So he has to be bought into it. He's been approached. I found the kind of the wording of it strange, and the way it was framed very strange from Tiger. But these conversations have been going back to Greg Norman in the 90s. And 240 million, I think 2 million purse a week. I kind of see this whole story as a little bit of a trial balloon, or a little bit of a warning to the PGA Tour of America and to the European Tour. Look, you need to maybe look at your purses. That's the way I kind of see this.
So just inject more prize money and it'll go away?
It's a negotiating tactic, I see it as. And I this idea of teams and having like 4 players per team, the Ryder Cup is great. We all love it every couple of years. But golf to me has always been an individual sport. The drama and the Hollywood and the movie drama of golf has seen someone leading the Masters, like Jordan Spieth did a couple of years ago, and then completely collapsing. And you're seeing players that would normally on a Thursday shoot 65 and be under no pressure, there's no cameras, or like relative to Sunday afternoon, then collapsing under the weight. And what about the democracy of someone like Shane Lowry, who won the Irish Amateur, won the Irish Open as an amateur, then going and winning the Open? Like, he was around in the 30s and the 40s of the rankings, but is a degree of exclusion then around having like golf changes? And you only see Rory now number one and Tiger. Remember when Tiger was in the doldrums, his ranking was completely like in the toilet, and now he's in the top 10 in the world again. So I just think it's like, unfortunately, with a lot of these deals and these things, and you're here in South Africa, the Six Nations and private equity firms, it all comes down to money. Look, it makes the world go round. We need it, but to me, it's a little bit.
Surely there can't be an argument, John, though, in terms of like the purses and. Big enough. I mean, golf now is at a level.
In sports, it's never big. It's never big enough.
I know there's but it does seem a big cash. It's pure cash grab. How's that going to go down with the golf in public? Surely they're not. The players haven't got the sympathy to golf in public. They're being underpaid, or the prize money. They're being undervalued. The prize money is huge. It seems to be.
Like Larry made $1.7 million for winning that Open at Portrush last year. But the Royal and Ancient and the US Golf USGA who set the rules. And they manage the majors, although the PGA of America manages the PGA, and the Masters is managed by, you know, Augusta. How would that work with the majors and the World Tour? Would we be part of it? I just think it's elitist, and I think golf, like the depth of the golf tours, is 150 players per event, is quite democratic, and like even this week, you've got the world's top six playing in Los Angeles in the Genesis Open. You can't say for certainty, a bit like the Premier League, that it'll be one of those top six that'll win it. Anybody could win it from outside. Like Mark Leishman stared down everybody there in the Farmers Insurance recently and won.
Yeah. And that's one of the joys of watching golf. Yeah. Paul Carrington's in the papers today. He's done an interview with Rick Broadbent of the Times. He's talking about the crowd issues at the President's Cup and talking about Patrick Reed's caddy being kicked out and bringing it back to the last time that they were in the States, and Rory getting a lot of crap from the crowd. People were saying things that I wouldn't be allowed to repeat on a family show at this point.
Beer. That's what I've just written down. Beer. Sort the beer out.
They're going to have very strict rules that if you cross the line, you're getting ejected. He's saying that at one stage it looked like Rory was going to go into the crowd and punch a man who had told him to beep my beep beep. And he was like, shit, I'm going to have to go in after him, because I can't let my mate go in there. He says, I'm raising young boys. I'm getting them to stand by their mates. But what if their mates lead them into a bad place?
Could you imagine that, in like Rory in a headlock with someone in the middle of the crowd?
Harrington, he said it would have been very embarrassing, the two of us throwing handbags. So he's got no...
But you can't have the environment can't be too sterile, can it? I cringe a little bit at this. I mean, that's the whole... That's the challenge of going over and actually winning a Ryder Cup in America, say, for example. That's the beauty of it. That's the satisfaction you get. There has been many Ryder Cup teams have gone over there and won. So it's actually because you have to overcome those obstacles, and that's not easy.
No,
I understand that. I know it's not acceptable. I don't hear him bad language. And,
he's fine with that.
But, you know, to a point, you can try and kind of, you know, it can't be so sterile where, you know what I mean?
Well, most majors are relatively genteel. Like the Opens I've been to, although Portrush last year was quite, there was a kind of halfway between stadium and genteel, and the Ryder Cup is stadium golf, and it should be that way, and it should be
the noise.
It should be the flags. It should be the war on the shore, and that got a little bit out of hand. But I think a lot of this has got to do with beer, and like people go and have, you know, like especially, you know, there's likes in New York and these places that you've seen at the majors there, that the people are just getting tanked up and having a go, and. Like
that's a bit like, yeah, it's trying to regulate that though, a bit of personal responsibility, make people aware. You just, you know,
it
what
seems
I mean?
To work in Phoenix. They've got that 16th hole in Phoenix, which is on Super Bowl weekend. It seems to work that they have that managed, and it's fun.
What is it? What's that?
In the Arizona tournament, Scottsdale, the Phoenix Open, that 16th hole, they have these like massive stands, and everybody, it's just a massive party.
Everybody gets hammered,
and everybody's going, yeah, and like, you know, and it's a par three, and it, like if somebody like Tiger Woods actually had a hole in one there in the 90s, it was amazing.
Do we remember the PJ Willis letter before one of the Ryder Cups? Danny Willis' brother.
Danny Willis' brother.
Yeah, so he's talking about that. That was before Darren Clark's.
All right, I've googled the letter here, and it's
quickly.
Will we go for a quick excerpt? Team Europe needs to shut these groupies up. They need to silence the pudgy basement-dwelling irritants stuffed on cookie dough and pissy beer, pausing between mouthfuls of hot dogs so they can scream Baba Booey until their jelly faces turn red. They need to stun the angry, unwashed Make America Great Again swarm, desperately gripping their concealed carry compensators and belting out mini-erection-inducing mashed potato, hoping to impress their cousin. They need to smash the obnoxious dads with their shiny teeth, Lego man hair, etc., etc., etc. PJ Willett, obviously.
Danny's brother. Danny Willett got dropped as a result of that. Harrington is saying that that was a big boo-boo on their part. They should have sent him out in the first four ball and said, get out there, get on with it, get over it. it was parody, everybody needs to calm down.
It was fun, yeah. Darren Clark got it completely wrong. He had a press conference, and it was like, oh, that was really bad, and you know, we apologise and all this kind of stuff. Yeah. PJ Willis made a kind of a reputation out of nowhere when Danny won the Masters earlier that year, I think it was. It was really, really funny, and that was an extension of that. But the way it was handled from Darren Clark at the time, I didn't think it was wrong. It should have been just brushed
not
off.
Not a great Ryder Cup captain, I think we can all agree, Darren Clark. Well, Rory Carrington going to be a very different kettle of fish.
Yeah, Nick Faldo, not a good captain. And the captain does matter. And I've always this, well, we have to rotate the captain. Why don't, if you've got a good captain, keep the captain. Tony Jacklin, great captain, keep him. Patrick Harrington, captain, keep him. This kind of like club-style rotation of it, I never really got that. And once again, I think it diminishes the Ryder Cup.
Harrington praising Keith Wood for a bit of advice that Wood gave him. Anytime I make a mistake, I try and do two simple things immediately afterwards before I try anything again. Mm. Harrington said that stuck with him, so he's not trying to rescue bad situations with Hail Marys. It's like, okay, I'm just going to do something simple, and then I'm going to try something spectacular after that. So
it'd be interesting how Padraig approached, because in terms of how he's approached his golfing career, you know, very introspective in terms of his approach, very detailed, the psychological side of things. He bought into that early on, John, in his career, didn't he, Padraig? It's always been interesting to listen to, interesting to see if he'll actually manage or coach players that way. You're talking about keeping it simple. Yeah. But Padraig's never really kept things simple in his own game.
No.
Is he? You know what I mean? So it'd be interesting to see if he actually kind of manages people that in that way.
Can he keep the intensity under wraps?
Time for John Duggan to make us some money this week here with Virtual Insanity.
Well, we're hitting the crossbar in Virtual Insanity recently. Webb Simpson was in my head, and then he went out of my head, and then he won in Phoenix, and that's the way things go in life. And then last week, we had three golfers that we picked. Jason Day was fourth, Jordan Spieth tied for ninth, hitting the crossbar in every single direction, and then Max Homa was tied 14th. So I wanted to get the first plane out of here, out of Ireland, but off the ball is a job that I do enjoy, so we stayed in the country, right? So we got 932 in the pot of virtual money. Never gamble more than you can afford. Always gamble responsibly. Euro here, Euro there. A bit of interest, but it's going to be four great days at the Genesis Open. Los Angeles Open, Tiger Woods' first tournament in 1992 as a 16-year-old. Gorgeous weather. We'd love to be there, but we're not. We're here, right? So instead, we'll just have to enjoy for the next 4 days. The top six golfers in the world, Rory, Brooks, all these, and Rory's now the number one. And Rory McIlroy is the first headline tip this week. €5 each way. Rory McIlroy, 15-2, won the HSBC Champions, third of the Farmers in his first event of the season. World number one, Brad Faxon, the putting guru, has helped Rory's game. It's not Augusta week. There's no pressure. Rory McIlroy shot a 63 in this last year. I think he liked the course. I think Rory McIlroy is a very solid player to finish in the top eight. Fifth of the odds at top eight, Paddy Power, Boyle, Skybet, and Betfair. These are really good odds to finish in the top eight. 15-2, 7.5-1. Rory McIlroy, he's an absolute cert to be in the top eight. I think you're going to make a small profit on Rory McIlroy for five each way. Three each way, Patrick Cantlay, sixth in the world. Have you ever heard of Patrick? Well, you should. Won the Memorial Tournament last year. Nearly won the Masters. Went bananas the last 2 days. Patrick Cantlay played well at Pebble Beach and former number one in the world as an amateur. Tied 15th last year in Riviera. Tied 4th year before that. Patrick Cantlay, unsung heroes. 20-1 for three each way. And the rank outsider for the holidays to California on Monday morning when you go to Dublin Airport. Two each way. Carlos Ortiz from Mexico. 150-1. 20th, 26th and 9th at Riviera. Course form. Loves the Poa Anua greens. Big hitter. 4th, 4th and 2nd this year. Much better form than when he was playing well at Riviera. Carlos Ortiz, 150-1 for two each way. Ortiz, McIlroy and Cantlay. McIlroy, though, is the winner this week.
John, good stuff. Thanks very much for that. Virtual Insanity every Thursday morning here on OTB AM. Pepsi Max is proud partner of the UEFA Champions League. Maximum taste, no sugar. And on the 29th of February, Off the Ball are running a skills challenge with the Champions League trophy in Dundrum Shopping Centre with David Myler and Damien Delaney, with thanks to Pepsi. The two former Premier League pros will also be in the Pavilion Shopping Centre on the 1st of March for another skills challenge with the trophy. Come down on either day for your chance to win a signed football from Leo Messi, as well as other spot prizes. Hashtag for the love of it. The Champions League trophy is the nicest trophy in world sport. I will hear no arguments.
You say skills, Damien Delaney and David Myler.
So you get everybody who comes
down. Could be the worst two-touch of all time.
Shade being thrown.
If you're going to get it on video.
You know that there's loads of footage of you playing football too.
I want to watch that. Them two playing two-touch. That's up and saying. I want to see video footage of that.
Oh, we will. Don't worry. Champions League trophy, nicest trophy in the world.
I've held the claret jug, and I've never held the Champions League trophy.
Oh, that's beautiful.
The World Cup.
No, the World Cup is just like a thing. Like, it's just a lump of gold.
It's one of them.
The Champions League trophy is iconic. And it's the first time that, like, it's...
World Cup's pretty iconic.
Well, it's the second World Cup trophy.
I don't really like the...
There's been two of them.
Yeah. Yeah,
like that's how iconic it is. There's a second one. There's a different one.
But like you can, it's possible to have two things that are brilliant. Yeah,
it can't be that iconic if you have it's a second tour. It's been redrafted.
I think trophies, trophies should have handles.
The Champions League trophy is the one.
I don't agree with that take whatsoever. Like trophies,
of course they should.
Handles are
how
practical.
How can you lift it? Exactly.
With your two hands on either side of the trophy.
Of the globe.
Like I can lift up this newspaper. It doesn't have handles on it. You don't need handles to lift something.
It's supposed to be a cup that you lift above your head.
It can't come in pieces either. It should be one entity. The amount of times you can see it coming a mile away, can't you? It's in two pieces, into separated, lift the top half, bottom half, falls,
yes,
crash onto the floor.
It's a nice, like the Wanamaker trophy, the PGA is just like too big. Even the Heineken Cup trophy is quite heavy. I think the Champions League trophy has got quite middle ground.
Perfect.
It's a nice middle ground trophy.
Yeah, go and see it, courtesy of Pepsi Max, and enjoy those 2 days. And we will, of course, be filming it. So we'll get Kenny to rate Damien Delaney and David Motter's skills. And then we'll send them the video so there can be a bit of trash talking.
And he can't use his head. They can't just put it on the head. That's typical centre-halves, get out with jail card.
We'll have to show you how to use your phone so you can see those videos as well. Right, Kenny, John, thanks very much for popping in, lads. We're not done here on OTB AM just yet. We're bringing you Owen's chat with Brian O'Driscoll next here on the show. It's been a really interesting morning. Kieran Donaghy, Kenny joining us in the studio from the top of the show. If you missed any of it, Shot Clock, our football stories and much more, you can check it all out in the podcast. Here's Owen with Brian O'Driscoll on Ireland's 2026 Nations so far.
Brian O'Driscoll on Off the Ball.
With Vodafone, official sponsors of the Irish rugby team. Team of us. Everyone in.
You are very welcome. Brian O'Driscoll, you are very welcome to studio. How are things?
Good on, thanks.
So it's Cork this week for a 23-man squad. Week off, two wins in the bag. It must feel pretty good, I'd imagine, in the middle of the Six Nations, getting into that week off with those two wins.
Yeah, listen, you know, they've started exactly as they would have wanted. Everyone talks about having to win your home games in the Six Nations and a huge amount of pressure, that pressure valve has been released on the basis of two wins. You would imagine that they shouldn't have any difficulty in dispatching Italy at home in round four. Mm. So, you know, anything hereafter is an added bonus from where we were post-World Cup in a new era under Andy Farrell. And now with confidence buoyed on the back of a really good performance against Wales, you know, the way England have stuttered a small bit and a couple of their big players not fit. There's every reason to be confident but wary as to what Twickenham will hold for us in whatever 10 days' time. So it's an exciting place, and it's a quick turnaround from even where we were after the Scotland game. I think there was a lot of doom and gloom. People got very much down on the team. It was almost the World Cup disappointment was reinforced with a bit of a lacklustre performance against Scotland. But, the grind they turned that victory into was then reinforced with a miles better performance against Wales and a very clinical display.
It's interesting thinking about the evolution of Ireland under Andy Farrell, because it's going to take a little bit longer for us to see the full form of it. But Sexton, in the aftermath of the game on Saturday evening, was saying, I think some of the messages that came out of our camp haven't been taken the way they should be. So he's referring to the Scotland week, and as you said, perhaps some of the negativity after the Scotland game. We have taken a lot of what Joe's done in the last few years and built on it, added bits to it, to suggest we have thrown everything away is just wrong. It is inaccurate. And that's exactly it. We're seeing some of the good elements of Joe Schmidt, and then perhaps some of the Mike Catt influence coming into play in attack?
Yeah, I would imagine so. Again, Mike Catt will have more of a stamp on what way he wants the attack shape to look with time, no different than Andy Farrell and with any coach that coaches at international level. It's difficult to stamp, have your imprint put on things immediately. So I think we have to be patient with that, but we're getting to see it. I think Mike Catt's style probably isn't overly dissimilar to what Stuart Lancaster likes to do at Leinster, so I think there's a bit of continuity for Sexton playing in blue and then again in green. I think with regards to the things that were said, it was more the unsaid word, and I think maybe some of those comments, you look at Ian Henderson's comments about the environment being different and a bit more open and a bit more communicative, you know, between coaching staff and players. And you have to remember, in all new environments, there's an excitement and a freshness.
Of course,
that was the case 6-7 years ago with Joe Schmidt. I was there, and we were thrilled to have a new voice, a new face in there, something that was different than we'd been hearing for the previous 3 or 4 years under Declan Kidney. We'd obviously had a taste of it at Leinster for a couple of seasons, or for 3 seasons. But I remember, you know, Paul O'Connell and those players coming in thinking, gosh, you know, how lucky you guys have been to have this quality of coaching. And then over the course of time, 4 or 5 years, the natural thing is for things to get a bit stale, and particularly when it's a little bit off and then the results aren't going for you, it unravels very quickly. Mm. And listen, let's judge Andy Farrell for what's happening at the moment. Will things be different in 4 or 5 years' time under Andy Farrell? And then when a new person comes in, will lads talk about that being fresh and great and a great new environment? Of course they will. That's the cycle of coaches.
Was Schmidt more a good cop at the start than he was at any point after?
I think so, but I was gone for a number of years. I only had a season of him at international rugby, and by all accounts, I think he got a lot firmer with the team. You know, he got harsher on them, but also they were a team that were growing, and maybe he felt the need to knock that bit of toughness into them, that, you know, standards needed to be excellent for them to achieve what they managed to achieve. So the only problem is, you know, the evolution of any side, players get fed up of that, and that's all well and good when you're winning. In 2018, I'm sure that there were some cracks there, but because they went an unbeaten season, because they beat the All Blacks, they won the Grand Slam, went away to Australia on tour, who's going to step, you know, pipe up and go, actually, I'm not happy with, doesn't matter, because they're winning.
Yeah.
So when things didn't go for us, and starting with the English performance early on this year, it opens an opportunity for people to go, well, I kind of thought I was keeping my mouth shut in the background, or I didn't like this. And then it's reinforced with Wales and again with England and Twickenham before the World Cup, and then Japan, and then, you know, kind of the coffin is sealed with the All Blacks performance. So 5, 6, 7 years is a long time for a coach to say fresh, new ideas coming in, and very few wave off in the sunset and go, thanks very much, you're welcome for what I've delivered. It more often than not ends in disappointment, and that's why coaches move on.
Yeah, of course it does. A couple of the new things that we've seen, a couple of the new ideas, perhaps Gordon Darcy in the Irish Times this morning saying Jordan Larmour, Bundiaki showing up as first receiver more often than before, and Jonathan Sexton appearing behind the rucks a little bit more often because the opposition can't guess which way he wants to bring the play. Is that in line with what you've been seeing? Is there anything else that you've noticed from the opening games?
Well, I think that's been coming from Leinster, to be honest.
Okay.
I think you look at the Irish team, they're trying to get to the middle a lot. And most sides try and get to the middle because that's where, you know, we talked about it last week, that's where you split that defensive line and you don't get as aggressive line speed. But what it also does is it gives you an opportunity to identify mismatches easier, or when someone hasn't ploughed numbers around the corner in defence, or if they've left the short side a bit sparse, when you sit in behind as first receiver, you can pick either side there. Whereas if you decide to choose one way or the other and you realise the far side is actually where the attacking threat is on, takes you 3-4 seconds to get there. The cavalry can pile around the corner. So it's a position of power to be able to sit in behind the ruck and almost weigh up which side is going to be to your benefit to attack down. Looking at what bodies you have on either side, what personnel you have on either side. Sometimes it's worthwhile going 5-on-5 or 6 defenders on 5 attackers if you've got 3 front rowers defending together on a blind side and you've got, you know, 2 wingers and 2 centres and an out half to go down and go, okay, let's try and pick off a mismatch here. So I think that is left up to the brain's trust, which ultimately is Conor Murray and Johnny Sexton, first and foremost, they're driving the direction
like
of where the team goes. Pardon?
It's almost like a quarterback role from the way you're talking there.
It's absolutely a quarterback role. And there's almost, the running back in Jordan Larmour is sitting behind Johnny Sexton as well. We saw it in the Scottish game where there was a break in the first 10 or 15 minutes, where he worked hard from a ruck on the left-hand side, and he's the extra body creating the numbers on that right-hand side. And he does that for Leinster the whole time. That's his point of difference. He's an ability under fatigue to be able to coast, and then accelerate and stay on the gas when he's made his breaks. He got an offload to Conor Murray, and ultimately it didn't come to anything, but they've made 40 or 50 metres up the pitch just through hard work and through being able to identify and outwork the opposition.
His try, Jordan Larmour's try, was unbelievable at the weekend. To me, I see the step and I see an amazing finish. What are you seeing? I presume there's a lot more to it than just that.
Yeah, there is. I kind of felt as though Conor Murray was looking for it for a while. It's a bit like, you know, when Jacob Stockdale gets an opportunity one-on-one, Ulster try and go to him a lot one-on-one because he nearly always beats his man, irrespective of whether it's his opposite winger defending against him or not. One-on-one, he fancies his chances. So it's about trying to create those opportunities for Larmour. So I saw Murray looking a couple of times and it wasn't quite on. And it first of all starts with Conor Murray's pass. The quality of it and where Larmour has to go with it. It immediately sends him on an overs, which is an outside break. It's out in front of him, which means he's accelerating, going full tilt onto it. He has to stretch for it. Exactly the sort of pass you want to stress defences. So what happens there is that Tompkins is in at second defender. He's got Wainwright on the inside. He's got Josh Adams on the outside. But Lee Halfmany is there to close the gate as well. But Josh Adams still feels as though he has to play soft. It's not ideal that far out from your line to be playing soft. So as soon as Tompkins sees Josh Adams' shoulders turn to the touchline, he feels under pressure, thinking Larmour's got gas. His reputation precedes him. He's going to burn me on the outside. And what you immediately do is don't get burnt there. So hard acceleration from Tompkins. Now, the first thing you do when you're accelerating hard, or sorry, the last thing you do when you're accelerating hard is you don't tackle low. You go high and grab. It's just a natural instinct to do it. It is such a hard thing to be going all out and then to put in a really low shot, an effective tackle to boot. So he goes in, reaches, and it's not even that impressive a step from Jordan Larmour. Gets hit 10 metres out. Tompkins should get a scrag for everyone else to be able to mop up on the inside, Wainwright or Thomas Williams, who's running the nine roll in behind, but somehow he's managed to get in. So there's a multitude of factors there. It's obviously the video analysis that people would have done on Jordan Larmour, that he's got this wicked outside break, so don't get smoked on the outside. But also Conor Murray's pass that sent him there, the overchase from Tompkins, and then the lack of insurance policy in Williams, who should have closed off. He should have still, and I think Williams hits him 5 metres out. He goes low, probably scrags him down a metre out. You scramble, you might survive it. But to concede when the first contact has been made 10 metres out is very, very disappointing defence.
So Jordan Larmour, can we get this level from him more consistently as a full-back or more consistently as a wing? Because you talk about almost the sideline being another defender, and because he can step off both feet, you're almost better off having him in a more central position, I'd imagine.
Undoubtedly better off a full-back. Gets more opportunities. I thought he had really good balance to his game at the weekend. Even when he runs down a blind alley, he's got good fight. He's not someone that concedes in the tackle and accepts a big impact coming at him. He might look small in stature. He's not tiny. He's bulky and he's obviously very powerful. You look at some other players that Chezen Colby comes to mind, where very small in stature but incredibly explosive. And Jordan Larmour is of that ilk, maybe not quite to that degree, but He's a very, very capable fighter in contact, and that's what you need when you're not always going to make the correct decisions when you try and counterattack, and you will run into heavy traffic sometimes. All you're looking for is good quality ball placement and to make sure that you fight for 1-2 seconds on the ground, wait for the cavalry to arrive, and then you can set up play thereafter. But it's the times that he does get it right, be it kick selection or counterattack, and then with the opportunity of offloading, I think is what differentiates him from other out halves that we have going on the circuit at the moment within the provincial setup. I think he's exciting, and it feels as though he's going to make things happen. Yeah. So players, if I was wingers or outside backs, I'd be just trail running him the whole time because it feels as though he's going to get his hands free a lot of the time.
We were chatting to Quinny about this on Monday, and he was, I think we were both kind of floating the idea that perhaps if you had Will Addison at full-back and Andrew Conway on one wing and Jordan Larmour on the other wing, you at least have an even more exciting prospect in the back three. I would accept that excitement often comes from the unknown, that because we haven't tried that before, we have these fanciful notions that would be amazing. It might be something cool to try against Italy, for example. I'm getting the sense, though, from you that it wouldn't be the most effective option. The back three we have right now are sort of an immovable object in terms of having their starting place.
Yeah, I have to say, and I've been critical of Jacob Stockdale, but questioned certainly the defensive side to his game, and I thought there was a lot of pressure on him this season to produce there. He hasn't had a huge amount to be asked of him, but I was very impressed in the first 10 or 15 minutes with him, with how many touches he got of the ball, how much action he looked for, how effective he was. He'd won questionable kick that got caught on the full by Dan Biggar, but I thought he had lots of really good moments. I thought the back three were very exciting. Conway, comfortably the standout performer. I think Quinny was the one that gave Stander the man of the match. I don't know how. I thought for me it was Conway way before his try. And second, Tadhg Furlong with his 65-minute stint or whatever he did. And then maybe CJ third. But I think the quality of the back three, the threat they had, the decisions they made, the simplicity of a lot of their play, just allowed the pack to get into shape and for the halfbacks to dictate play.
For the third consecutive Six Nations, we're going to have a conversation about the midfield power rankings and depth chart within Ireland's squad. Gary Ringrose picks up an injury. Ireland's form 13, potentially Europe's form 13 in the first half of the season and going into 2020 as well.
Bakatawa might have something to say about that.
He might have something to say about that.
We'll let that one slide.
Does he go straight back into the team? Because on the form of Robbie Henshaw and Bundy Aki as a duo, as a partnership in midfield, you're looking at that and you're thinking, let's power on with this. Now, he's going to be out for the England game more than likely, Ringrose. So it's not a conversation we need to have just yet. But I think given Henshaw's performance the weekend, it's probably something we should consider.
Yeah, and you have to remember too, before the World Cup, you know, Henshaw and Aki were going to be the centre pairing going into it. They were the two that played well against Wales. Gary Ringrose was struggling for form. You know, he's coming off the bench and onto the wing, or being pushed from centre onto the wing, and he couldn't quite get a grip of what he wanted to do. Obviously, the possession or the way the game was being played probably didn't suit him as much. I think he's really enjoying that at Leinster, and we're seeing the best of him. I think he's not having to carry in close quarters as much under Stuart Lancaster and Leo Cullen or Andy Farrell as he maybe did under Joe Schmidt. And that's to his benefit. He's kind of your stereotypical 13 outside break, good footwork, good offloading game, decent passer. So use those skills rather than getting him to carry the ball over advantage line. Of course, he'll have to do that occasionally, but I thought there was too much of that in his game. And he's willing to do it. He's a selfless player, so he's willing to sign up for that. But I think if you've got to have a game plan that has the ability to be malleable to the qualities of what the skill set of the individuals are as well. And I think we're seeing the best of Gary Ringrose. He was in a really rich vein of form. And in fairness to, you know, we questioned Robbie Henshaw as whether is this his moment to step in. He's 26, coming into the prime of his physical career. He's got bagloads of experience. He's been unfortunate with some injuries, but I was really impressed with the aggressiveness of his carrying, with the willingness to offload and the quality and the skill of some of the offloads. There was one to Henderson, which he seemed had in kind of the palm of his hand, but he flicked out of it, you know, right into his breadbasket. I just thought that's a player playing with high confidence and is being given the rope to be able to go and throw those sort of passes. I think that's the sort of pass that you would have stuck a year or 2 years ago, played, you know, continuity, go through the phases, whereas now changing that point of contact, he made two offloads within 30 seconds and it added, I'd say, 15, 20 metres of advantage line to Ireland. And we've got to become that sort of team. I was looking at the halftime stats. I didn't see them on full time, but It was like six offloads to 14 to Wales. Now, six is still okay for a half. Yeah. There will be lots of games where we'd have three and four. So six and a half is still good. And we're getting there. And I think that has to be... We've got to be a team that's willing to take a few more risks. Because when we come up against the bludgeon, get into the arm wrestle, that's where we get knocked out. Mm-hmm. So we have to have that adaptability to be able to throw the pass and throw the offload and use the skill set that we know that we're capable of. It just felt as though we were confining ourselves to a stereotype that didn't suit us in the last year. Let's break the shackles from that and play a bit more freely and let people express themselves. And I think we saw aspects of that.
I wanted to get your thoughts on Matt Williams's comments on Virgin Media over the course of the weekend, because himself and Ronan O'Gara had a bit of an argument about whether or not this performance from Ireland against Wales should be the minimum. He said it was the minimum that should be acceptable from this group of players, and he says everyone's made excuses for this group in the past. Is that something you go along with, that this should be the minimum for Ireland?
I think, you know, within the setup, you probably think this is our benchmark. Mm. But I don't think it's a hard and fast statement where if we dip, you know, a couple of percent below it, that we're going to, you know, lambaste one another or lose the head. I think it's anytime you have a good performance, it's more of a reminder to yourselves that that's what we're capable of. So why would we dip below that when we can get to here? I don't necessarily think that, I don't know, I don't want to get in Matt's head and understand what he was saying about it, but I think they're probably saying something similar within the setup. So I don't know why, you know, I think it looks good on TV when you get a bit argumentative. I could also see Roger's point of view, the way Matt was saying, because of where he came from, his previous comments as well, it seemed like a harsh comment on the back of a great performance, but I if it wasn't inferred that way, I think it's a fair enough comment that that's the standard now they know that they want to get to and continually be at. And if they can do that, they'll be a very hard team to beat. You dip below it and you'll be susceptible to better teams getting the better of you.
Is he on the money when he says that, so about a camp or being inside the camp? Say from your experience, would there ever be a big win or a big performance? And it's not so much the ecstasy of the win, potentially that it lasts for a while, but as the dust settles a couple hours later, you're like, right, okay, this is the benchmark now. We have to... I don't know. We do not let this slip to quote.
I don't think you think that way. Okay. I think you think more. This we can play like this. So let's try and get to that every time. Mm. I don't think you think we can't get below that, because that's a bit of a negative comment.
Okay, yeah.
It's more about thinking positively. That look at some of the brilliant rugby that we did play. You know, great retention, great skill set. So okay, now let's just remind ourselves that this is the brand that we're capable of. Let's do it week on week. Mm. So it's a bit glass half full rather than glass half empty. And I think that's the way that they'll be looking at the video footage. And they'll realise the things that they can improve on. And there's absolutely scope for that. But for the most part, defensively very good as well. Mm. Spacings were excellent. You know, their ability, it felt like a role reversal from a couple of years ago where Wales were getting us on the edge a good bit. And we were getting so narrow in defence.
2018.
Kind of 2018. Even when we beat them, they still got a couple of tries out in the 15. They managed to stretch us where we got narrow. I couldn't get over how narrow Wales got and how much we were able to get out into the extremities. You know, I'm sure Sean Edwards must have been looking kind of with a wry smile, because it just looks like a completely different defensive setup, with them trying to play aggressive line speed but not having the spacings. And we had the quality of pass and the depth to be able to you know, encourage those shooting defences and still get the pass away. Saw one for Conway's try from Larmer, great pass from Keith Earls to Larmer, and if Stockdale hadn't overrun it, it probably would have been the bonus point try with 20 minutes to go. So, you know, I think there was so much positivity to take from it. And like I say, most of the time when I come in here, it looked better second time round again, and probably it'll look better each time you watch it.
The key question, Brian, is, are we seeing more dog in this Irish team?
I think there's Yeah, there looked like there was a nastiness in some players. I think Tadhg Furlong is a guy that looks as though he's playing to prove a point. You have to remember, he had a quiet enough World Cup. Andrew Porter got selected for the Northampton game away from home, and Furlong was benched. And sometimes that works in a coach's favour, where they've got two players similar enough quality vying for the same position, and you bench one for a while. It's just a small little reminder that we can live without you, particularly how well Porter was playing. But I think since then, Furlong, I've been very impressed with him the last two weekends. His work rate, the appetite in defence, kick chase, things that you wouldn't associate someone driving from a tight head position.
Yeah.
The last play of the game against Scotland, the amount of moments he had in that, working hard where it looked as though he had cramp and playing through it. I was really, really impressed with him. And he looks as though he's carrying super hard with a lot of aggression. And maybe we don't need that level of Sean O'Brien. And I'm not saying that things were taken out of context in that. I'm not saying that some of those players don't possess any aggressiveness, but I just don't think there's a Sean O'Brien there.
What do you mean, as in bending the rules a little bit? Or?
Not even that. I just thought everything he did was so confrontational.
Okay.
Everything. And the players that have played with him will understand that more than anything. That it just, he demanded so much every time. You knew that it was 100 miles an hour and that he never, ever took an easy option. If he could carry, I never saw him carry at 98 or 99%. It was 100% every time. Same with every shot. And it's a mentality. And I think that type of player is quite unique. You don't get them every generation. I think you might get a couple every generation. And I think comparatively, if you were to ask, and I'm sure no one likes reading that, there's question, there's dog in them. But I don't think, I stand by, I don't think any of those players are of that Sean O'Brien ilk of dog or being an on-field tug.
Can they become that player?
I think it's probably built in you or not. I think it's really a mentality. And listen, there's guys, I think CJ Stander, the aggressiveness that he is playing with and hitting with is hugely admirable at the moment. I think he's a key component. Obviously, he's gotten two man of the matches, so without stating the obvious, but I read an article that talked about him being constantly questioned. I would absolutely love him to develop an offloading game, because if he can, he will be unplayable. I just don't feel as though he looks as though he's going to get the ball out of contact. And there's lots of chances to do it, because he's got such aggression to get beyond the tackle where he can turn his body and actually get it away. It just feels as though sometimes he's looking for another yard himself, rather than realising the work is done there, the defence is scrambling, now look for the offload. And if he can do that, I think he will be a real standout performer in the Six Nations for this Irish team for the next few years.
We are out of time, Brian, but you did say a player who expects the most from their teammates, and I can't leave you go without asking about Sexton, and I guess that element of his character that often comes out, but now what we're seeing is a dialogue to Johnny Sexton because he's Ireland captain. What did he make of his interactions with Roman Pott on Saturday?
Yeah, I think at times you could understand why he came in a little bit frustrated at one or two decisions. Looking back at the video, I think from both sides' perspectives, there were a couple of questionable ruck calls. It seems sometimes it's a bit of a free-for-all under Pott. But I thought Johnny, he grew into the game, although he got better in the second half. Johnny Wilkinson made a really good point. Maybe the time to go harder at the referee is when you've scored rather than when the opposition have scored. I think sometimes you have to take your foot off and accept that they've got a bit of momentum there, and there's no point in antagonising the referee because it's almost reinforcing that he thinks that team is in the ascendancy.
Okay.
When you get frustrated and get annoyed. So sometimes, that's a time to let something go. And Johnny will learn that with time, of understanding you can't have a go every time you're annoyed. You've got to pick your moments. You've got to pick your battles. And there was, there was a few things that you look back and there's sliding doors moments where I think there was a penalty on 5 minutes into the second half and he got two penalty options, one on the touchline and one won around the 15, and it was a 12-7 game. You knock that over, it's a two-score game. But yet he went to the more difficult penalty in the corner. Van der Veer scored the try. But I think don't run the risk. You've got to score a line out. You've got to make sure that the line out maul is good enough. And
I get you'd be going for a post in that situation. Absolutely.
Even in hindsight. 8-point game. Two scores is where you want to get to. There's a security that comes with two scores. It doesn't matter how it comes. So it gets to, I think he knocked over the conversion. So it's 19-7. That's a 12-point game. But that's still two scores. Mm. So granted, it's a try and two tries and a conversion. But you know, the way Ireland were defending, that's a difficult line to break. They were, you know, the discipline was only okay. But I just think those sort of things, because there was a try, no one will ever talk about it. But I think there are things that you just always have to look back and kind of wonder, should I have done that in that time? I personally would have kicked it goal, definitely.
Yeah, and I'm sure he's being super critical of all the decisions and the coaching staff are this week as well.
Well, we're scrutinising all the negative. You know, there was positive things where he got, you know, besides the way he played the game, his defensive moments, but quiet things that we probably didn't hear him saying to Romain Poit that we're oblivious to, that, you know, helped us get into the game or helped him build his relationship with Poit. So I think he's doing okay. But listen, we're on radio here to pick holes, aren't we?
Absolutely. We'll be picking holes again next week. Brian, thanks a million for popping in. I'm sure this time next week we'll have some Eddie Jones comments to sink our teeth into ahead of the big one in Twickenham. Chat to you next time, Brian.
Cheers.
OTB
AM. Brought to you by Pandora. Find the perfect gift this Valentine's Day.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.